You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
Of KPFA and Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California. This is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today with Kevin Pena on the show, we spend the entire hour dealing with, well, what the hell is going on in Haiti? Who are those mercenaries that were taken out of the country? First, they were found armed, but for some reason, the U.S. Embassy felt comfortable taking these eight mercenaries out of the country, and they weren't even handcuffed. We're going to figure out what the hell is going on in Haiti. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine, and we have one hell of a story from you. It centers on Haiti, the mercenaries in Haiti, related actions. There was a massacre in the Peruvian embassy. There have been death squad killings for a month, and we're going to find out who these guys were. There's a lot of questions. Joining us is Flashpoints senior producer Kevin Pena. Kevin Pena has a long history reporting in Haiti. This is where we came together. He was a documentary filmmaker on the ground trying to document the reinstitution of democracy with President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, and he found himself back then in 1990 in the middle of a coup. Well, the situation continues. U.S. involvement obviously continues based on what we now know about the way, for instance, Kevin, that these mercenaries were treated. But
two coups, right? I was there in 2004 for the second coup.
I was back for that one. All right. To set up the story, it starts
longer than that, of course. It goes all the way back to 2004, really, the coup d'etat.
All right, but let's pick it up.
Protests, right? Major, massive cycles of protests. The last cycle of protests have been centered on the Petrocaribe Fund of the Venezuelan government, which was intended to give Haiti fuel at reduced rates, and the balance of payments was supposed to be used for investment in development projects and infrastructure projects in Haiti. The government of Michel Martelly, the founder of the PHTK party, which is now the current ruling party, known as the bald-headed party or the skinhead party is another word that I've heard used to describe it. And the current president, Jovenel Moise, are accused directly of having diverted more than $3 billion of that fund. The numbers are between $3 to $4 billion have gone missing from that fund that was meant for development in Haiti. Now, we forward to this last cycle of major protests in Haiti in November. All of a sudden, we have these new players come on the field. They're called the USGPN. They're using the insignia of the USGPN. The USGPN is the Presidential Security Unit of the National Palace, but clearly they have brand new pickups, which have brown camouflage. They have 50 millimeters mounted on the back. We haven't seen those kinds of pickup trucks with 50 millimeters mounted on the back since the days of the old Haitian military, which used to terrorize the population. So, of course, it drew a lot of attention. But more than that, there were selfies being taken by some of the soldiers who clearly were identified, were not speaking Creole. We're not speaking French. We're speaking English. We're speaking Spanish. We're speaking other languages. People heard them talking to each other. These were clearly identified as foreigners. Now, they were shooting at the population. They had snipers. They were taking selfies of themselves, sniping We have some of that footage on at Haiti Info
Project.
But
they weren't attacking the government. They were attacking
the protesters. Yes. We were calling them back then foreign mercenaries hired by the current president of Haiti and the PHTK party in order to quell these demonstrations.
And it was extreme violence.
To terrorize them. Terrorize them with big guns, by shooting them, by sniping at them, by firing at them, doing the dirty work that they would like the Haitian police to do. But they like the Haitian police to play this game of being good cop, bad cop. Forgive the forgive the metaphor, but it's true. And so back in November, even the head of the Haitian police said, we don't know who these foreigners are. We've never seen these guns before. These are big guns. These are clearly military equipment, great equipment. Our police force doesn't even have that. But these guys are flying the flag of the presidential security of the National Palace. So now, there were eight foreigners detained, five Americans among them, one Haitian national with close ties to the ruling party of Jovenel Moïse, the PHTK, and one Serb and one Russian national, both of whom had residence cards in the United States, have permanent residency in the United States. Their residence cards were showed. So they were apparently at a police checkpoint that was set up randomly. They didn't have license plates, so they were pulled over. And they were told, we're going to search you. They searched the truck and they found heavy armaments, heavy guns, drones, communications gear, everything that you would consider a mercenary to need if you were in the field in Haiti, several sets of license plates. Some of the license plates that they had have been also tracked back to high officials of the PHTK ruling party. Yes. Magali Habitan is one of the names that is registered for one of the license plates. She is a
that they
close,
found in the mercenaries
she is in the,
car.
She is in the inner circle of the PHTK government. And so these guys are arrested and they say, hey, call your bosses. Our bosses are going to call your bosses. This is a big mistake. As if this is just going to go away. The police on the scene say, no, we're not going to make any calls. They arrest them because I guess there are still maybe a couple honest cops in the Haitian police department. It's hard to know because, you know, they've been heavily infiltrated and that the CIA has been recruiting from among their ranks. We know that for a fact. But apparently there were a couple guys who actually took these guys on and arrested them. And they were brought in, and by that time, the press had gotten involved, and they couldn't just be released. So they spent a couple days in jail, in custody. And just this afternoon, they were released in an agreement between the current ruling party, PHTK party of Jovenel Moïse, the president who is being protested against for the corruption of his party and absconding the between $3 to $4 billion I mentioned yes. earlier, and the U.S. embassy. They were escorted. The five Americans were escorted.
The heavily armed
U.S.
Americans were
who all have military backgrounds,
led,
by the way.
And there is you've got the visual. They're being led. They're not in handcuffs.
No.
These armed men who arrested. They're being led out of the country free, you know, by an official of, I guess, the U.S. Embassy.
That's
or
right.
the United
being escorted
States
out
government.
To the two American taking, Airlines.
And
flight.
Now what? We're hearing that these armed men who were part of a larger group that was spending a good amount of time gunning down protesters, apparently working for the government because all these protests were taking place against the government.
Well, we got it extremely suspicious because these guys said, we're there on a government mission. That was the first thing that they said.
That was what they
first
said when they were arrested.
When they were arrested, right. And your boss has to talk to our boss. The second thing they said was, we're working for the... Then a PHTK official came and said they're working for the Bank of the Republic of Haiti, that they were doing a special job for them, for security.
With all those
And then the Bank of the Republic of Haiti said, we don't know who these guys are. We didn't hire them. And then the PHTK sent two more officials to try to get them released, and the police refused to release them. And then all of a sudden you've got CNN talking to the current prime minister who says, oh, they were here to kill us.
Right, all of a sudden.
To kill PHTK officials, you know, all of a sudden. Well, do you think that if they had thought that those Americans were there to actually kill the president or the prime minister of Haiti, that they would have been allowed to walk being escorted by the U.S. Embassy onto an American
free flight?
It's an incredible story. Just amazing. But the point is, we know that protesters were killed by foreign mercenaries in November, and we were unable to identify them. This is the closest we've come to any reasonable explanation of who these people are and what they were doing inside of Haiti.
All right, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's Flashpoint senior correspondent Kevin Pina. He is an expert on Haiti, has spent many years in Haiti, continues to follow it very closely, has been breaking the story hour by hour in terms of these mercenaries that were now, these dangerous mercenaries. Supposedly the Haitian president is saying that they were there to kill him, but they were taken out of the country. They were not handcuffed. They were not treated like terrorists.
Well,
and now they're on their way, what, to the FBI?
Well, here's the thing, is that clearly in order for them to leave the country, I know because I've been arrested in Haiti before, as you know, a couple times. And in order for me to leave the country, I have to have what's called the commissaire du gouvernement, which is the government prosecutor, sign a release, right? The only way that they would have signed that release is if the PHT government had agreed, President Jovenel Moïse himself and Prime Minister Henri Saint himself and the U.S. Embassy. That's the only way that the government prosecutor would have signed the release allowing them to leave the country. So do you think they would have done that if they honestly thought that they were trying to kill them? I don't think so. These were, again, the best reasonable explanation we have is that these were the people we were trying to identify in November, who the Haitian police said they didn't know who they were with these big guns. These foreigners who were taking selfies, who were posting them online, who were bragging about the great job they were doing, repressing the demonstrations. The only reasonable explanation is that this is part of that crew that was there in November killing protesters.
All right, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Let's see if we can get in touch with Pierre Labossiere and talk a little bit more about what's going on here, get his response, and also talk about the massacre that happened at the Peruvian embassy. Maybe, Mike, we could take a little bit of a musical break, and we'll come on back. Let's come on back with Pierre Labossiere. We're going to continue this discussion. Again, Dennis Bernstein here. Mercenaries taken out of the country, out of Haiti by the United States embassy. Supposedly, these are folks who were caught heavily armed and somehow they could leave the country, walk out of the country, escorted by U.S. officials on their way to the FBI. Who the hell are these people? Who are they working for? Is this more of the same policy in which the U.S. government is engaged in various levels of undermining the popular, the undying popular resistance of the Haitian people? Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is Dennis Bernstein here with senior producer Kevin Pina, joined on the telephone by our good friend Pierre Labossiere, who is deeply engaged, Haitian-American, deeply engaged in the battle, the ongoing, endless battle for liberation in Haiti. Pierre Labossiere, thanks for being with us. Let's just get some of your initial impression. This is an amazing situation. Now you've got the United Nations just a few hours ago leading these so-called heavily armed mercenaries out of the country on a U.S. Plane and unarmed. Your thoughts on what's going on here and the implications? Pierre?
Hello? Thank you, Dennis, for having me. Thank you, Kevin, for breaking this story. And it's no surprise for, and as Kevin pointed out, the historical background of this. When we look at the United Nations occupation of Haiti, and this is the important part of it. Haiti has been under an occupation of UN troops. I know the UN doesn't have its own troops, but it's really soldiers from different countries, Brazil and all of the others. They are in charge of the police in Haiti. They are in charge. The current mission is the MINUSUS. They just change the name. They are supposed to be there to oversee the justice system, which includes the police and the prisons. So people in Haiti have been, and we know the horrendous massacres and the horrendous jail conditions that the UN troops have been involved in. I mean, it's on videotape. And so within that, we are not surprised at this latest news as these stories are coming out. The people of Haiti have been saying all along that they are, in addition to the UN troops that are accompanying the Haitian police in their murderous raids on the population. I'm thinking here in November, the massacre of La Saline, when it's been estimated that close to 300 people were killed during the month of November in the neighborhood of La Saline. For what? What was their crime? Because the people stood up and said, we cannot live under those conditions, the conditions of misery, the theft of public funds, the fact that so many people are getting, well, the few families are getting rich by stealing the money, government officials, and this money is supposed to have been there to provide services for the population. And to add insult to injury, the people are expected to repay this money, which is not being used for them. So, and many people were meeting the reports of mercenaries in Haiti with skepticism. Oh, well, people in Haiti, they exaggerate and everything. But the people knew. They knew. And here it is right now, where these forces are clearly seen. And this is within the context also of the United Nations occupation, as they are trying to recreate the old, brutal, criminal Haitian military. So these guys have been there from what I've been hearing, and it's not just these eight. From what I've been hearing from grassroots organizations, there are others in different parts of Haiti. And what are they doing? Very clearly, it's been indicated that they've been, as Kevin was pointing out, taking shots at people. Little kids, students have been getting headshots. Peaceful unarmed demonstrators have been getting killed. I mean, headshots or shot to the heart. And it's things like that that are taking place. And many people believe that they are there to also provide training for this, for the remobilization of the criminal Haitian military. So this is really something that needs to be exposed. The questions have to be raised. There's got to be deeper investigation into what's going on. Similarly, the other big issue, big story in Haiti is the fact that on February 12th, and again, these are various reports from media people and also from grassroots activists during a demonstration where the demonstration was attacked by the police, and several activists tried to get away from the tear gas and the bullet being fired at them by the police, by the Haitian police. And so they ran into the embassy or the consulate of Peru, and which I think the same building house is also the consulate of Italy. And there, many people have said, there are many reports that these people who had run in there, many of them were killed inside. And so,
I mean, they were tracked, they were pursued by Haitian security forces and shot dead inside the Peruvian embassy?
those are some of the reports that are that were being discussed on Haitian in Haitian media and in various by various observers in Haiti. So this is being discussed quite a bit, and so there has been no tangible evidence of it. But people are determined. They talk about it all the time. They say there has been no. The questions have been asked. There is no, nobody is actually saying no, that it didn't happen, but there is complete silence about it. And so people are determined to see, to get to the bottom of this story. We hear many reports of that in Haitian media. And so what's going on is so many atrocities are taking place inside Haiti. And the elite that dominates Haiti, they have a sense that of impunity, that they can get away with anything and everything. And so this is what's going on in the country. So a lot of things need light needs to be shed. And one thing I want to say about this, finally, at the insistence of a number of news reporters, they had a tour of the building where they took a video of it. And the video of the tour, there are shell casings that are inside the consulate, and they have also said they saw traces of blood. There were some rooms that they wanted to go into, that they were prevented to go into these rooms. But this is a big question mark, and it's being debated quite a bit inside Haiti. And I think that the later story of the mercenaries has kind of overshadowed this. But just before the mercenaries, that's what was being
discussed. It's a big story. I mean, think about it in the context of what happened in the Turkish embassy with the Saudi journalist.
Precisely.
That was one person who was assassinated, a horrific situation. But here you've got the U.S. trained and armed Haitian security forces tracking in an absolutely huge violation of international law, tracking people into a foreign embassy and murdering or shooting them there. This is a very big story.
No, it is. It is. And the question is, whether some people say they were pursued inside by the police, others say that the security inside actually shot them. So there are many questions that need to be raised and that need to be answered. And even in the days of Papa Doc Duvalier, when Papa Doc at one point had threatened to go inside a consulate, an embassy, in order to get his political opponents who had sought refuge there. There was such a massive outcry worldwide that he was forced to back down from those threats. And now for this to have taken place, or at least alleged, and there is a lot of strong evidence, and many who had gone on this tour, some of the Haitian reporters, are very, very concerned, and they are not letting this story go, except that the story of the mercenaries now has been dominating the news since that happened on Sunday.
Since they weren't arrested and walked freely out of Haiti into the loving arms of the FBI. Dennis Bernstein here with Flashpoint senior producer Kevin Pina. Kevin is an expert on Haiti. We're also joined by Pierre Lebossier, who was on the front lines of this battle, this endless battle in which perhaps a people more dedicated to fighting for self-determination and democracy than any other people I know in this world, so oppressed with the constant, continuous hundreds of years of support from the United States government. Kevin, join us.
It's interesting you should say that, because I was actually talking to Pierre the other day, and I said, you know, brother, I see people in these current protests who I have seen on the streets for 15 years protesting.
Still resisting.
Still
after
resisting.
All this
literally.
Time.
OG, okay? Yeah. You want to talk OG, old gangster, old militants? I mean, these guys literally, I've been looking at footage. You know, I got it from all over the place in the country. And literally, they've been popping up. These guys have been at it for 15 years, since 2003. These guys have been protesting, which, of course, draws a straight line of all of this back to the coup of 2004. That's really...
when the U.S. kidnapped Aristides.
Exactly. And when they overthrew the constitutional government. You know, there's no way that a Martelly could have happened. There's no way that a Moët Jovenel could have happened. And, of course, we're talking election fraud. We're talking U.S. and international community backing of election fraud, bringing this government to power. We're talking the intervention directly of back then, the Secretary of State, Hillary Rodham Clinton. But, of course, we're also seeing that it's no different under the Trump administration. So whenever those great Make America Great Again folks get on my timeline and they ask and they say, well, oh, this is the result of the Clintons. Well, yeah, what the Clintons did was reprehensible, but remember that the current man in charge of U.S. foreign policy in Haiti is an Obama-Clinton holdover, Kenneth Merton, the Haiti special coordinator that Trump continues to allow to run that policy there.
Amazing. And Pierre was talking about what happened in the Peruvian embassy. We've seen the arrest take place. It's so incredible how these stories do not get reported, how idiotic, forgive me, Kevin, the reporters must be to not ask questions about why six or seven are arrested. Not only being they're released, they're not handcuffed. They're arrested with heavy weaponry.
They're being escorted by U.S. embassy personnel.
What the hell were they doing there? And why is not the U.S. corporate press asking questions about that? I mean, it is so obvious. Why aren't they in? Terrorists go out in handcuffs. They're lying down. They're dragged out. They're wrapped up like freaking mummies. These guys walk out of there free and head for FBI headquarters. What, they're going to be debriefed about what? About what, killings, as Pierre was talking about in the last month, slaughters that they've been taking part in. Yeah. Are we going to get a recounting of all the different people they shot over?
I put money on that debriefing happening in a bar.
Yeah. All right.
One of the things
Pierre,
I think
yes, please,
is that same as the Khashoggi. What had happened in the embassy there, the Saudi Arabian embassy in Turkey, if it weren't for the persistence, at first they denied it. They denied that something had happened. They claimed that Khashoggi had left, or that he had even been in there. But same way, eventually, with the persistent questioning, the truth finally was revealed, that there was a horrific thing that happened. And the way that people in Haiti... Now, these are people who have been in the streets, who are demonstrating, who know what they are saying. They are persistently raising that issue day in and day out. Even today, I heard somebody was talking on the radio and saying that and raising it as well and say, we cannot forget what happened there. We need to get to the bottom of this. What has happened to our comrades? There are many families that are searching for loved ones, because in Haiti, people are being disappeared. So what the Haitian police would do, and some of the Tonton Macoutes of Jovenel Moïse and Martelly, what they would do is wait after the demonstration is over and ambush people. They ambush them during the demonstrations, but at times when people are leaving, going home, that's when a number of them end up missing. And there are many parents who are looking for their kids, some of them are students. One horrific thing that happened right in front of the hospital there, the general hospital in downtown Port-au-Prince. 13-year-old kid, 13 years old. He is helping his mother. She's selling bottled water. And when the police started showing up there, beating up on people, he was helping his mom get the water out of the way so that they can, this is how they earn a living. And a cop just shot him cold-bloodedly, shot him dead right there. The kid was only 13. His birthday came up, that happened about 10 days ago. His birthday came up, I believe, 2 or 3 days ago. That's when he turned 14. But they shot him dead. And the mom one of the things that the Haitian police does, when they shoot people, sometimes they disappear the bodies. And so the mom, you should see, and Kevin has it on Haiti Info Page, and it's also on our Facebook page, Haiti Action Committee, where his mother is giving interviews. I mean, the woman is traumatized, and she's sitting on his body as a way to protect her son. It's heart-wrenching. It's disgusting what's happening.
Pierre, we find it obviously disheartening. It's incredible to have you and Kevin here so that we can paint a real picture of what's going on. Kevin is here.
Well, I know, Pierre, there's going to be an event coming up soon that you wanted to let the audience know about, right?
Yes, yes. We are, and this is going to be on March 2nd, Saturday, March 2nd, from 3 to 5 p.m., and it's going to be at Eastside Arts Alliance, 2277 International Boulevard, also known as, formerly known as East 14th Street, and it's from 3 to 5 p.m.
Oakland, California.
Can get
Oakland,
the information.
California. It's in Oakland. And what's the website and all that stuff?
Yeah, the website is HaitiSolidarity.net. People can get that information there, and they can also go to our Facebook page, Haiti Action Committee, Facebook Haiti Action Committee. You can Google it. You don't have to be on Facebook to access it. It's there. And also you can definitely link to Kevin Pina, Haiti Info Page, and Kevin can talk about that, give the correct address, because there you'll get a lot of information about what's happening on a daily basis.
Okay, well, we thank you, Pierre, for all the good work and keeping us informed and working with our friend here, Kevin, who has been doing such incredible work for so many years.
As has Pierre. Just incredible what Pierre and the community have been doing to keep people informed and, you know.
People who listen to this show know more about the real situation on the ground in Haiti than anywhere else in this country. We're going to thank you, Pierre. We're going to take a short break. Some of the folks in other parts of the country are going to hear a piece we did about the power of the Israeli lobby. We're going to come back with Kevin and keep talking about Haiti. Stay with us. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Dennis Bernstein here with Kevin Pina. We are watching, we have a laser beam on what's going on in Haiti, where mercenaries obviously working. We're going to tell you more about them, because believe me, the more you know about these guys who walked out of that country free, even though they were busted with having major automatic weaponry, driving cars around with
multiple license plates.
They weren't on the car, but they had lots of license plates
in the
trunk. But they were taken out by U.S. officials. This is 200 and how many years of repression of Haitian liberation? But these guys have a history of these mercenaries, don't they? There's a lot of questions here.
You know, Navy SEALs. Fighting in Afghanistan.
Oh, most of them were in Afghanistan.
Yeah, most of them work with military contractors, you know.
Shooting Afghanis.
I'll just give you a couple examples. For example, there is Mr. Let's find him here. I got it here. Chris Osmond, former Marine Navy SEAL, sharpshooter.
sharpshooter. He was taken out of the country.
Yes,
no handcuffs.
Absolutely. No handcuffs.
But he was called lots of weaponry, driving around Haiti.
U.S. embassy personnel escorted him out personally.
Do we know if he was one of the people that might have been shooting in the Peruvian
embassy? This canard by the Haitian government saying that they were the target of these guys.
What a joke.
What a joke. I mean, if that had any credibility, is there any way that,
that they would walk out
with U.S. embassy
cuffs?
Right, and that they'd be, right, that they would be escorted by U.S. embassy personnel in a deal cut between the government and the embassy? Come on. What a joke.
But the idiot corporate press, they have zero IQ when it comes to foreign policy.
Chris
and
Stephen McKinley.
Who's he?
He's also a former Navy SEAL who served in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Afghanistan.
And so here he is.
Here he is. And of course, it's really interesting that a lot of
only
these guys
in America,
fought in
Haiti.
Afghanistan. And the current U.S. ambassador appointed by Trump to Haiti also comes out of Afghanistan. She was part of the civilian component of what we would call the contemporary version of Operation Phoenix inside of Afghanistan and the countryside.
Back when you were in Haiti, facing off with armed folks.
You do remember Operation Phoenix, right, in Vietnam? Right,
Yes.
That little pattern of where you recreate these little villages that you then protect, and then you burn everything else around it, right? And you then try to rebuild it from the ground up with all of them, like, loving you because you're just dumping money on them.
All right. Back in the day when you were in Haiti facing off for us on the ground, making it to various death squads, being named on death radio.
Getting arrested.
Getting arrested, brutalized, all that kind of stuff. Back then, we were monitoring a number of interesting situations that have to do with why perhaps U.S.
The press
doesn't report the truth. Now, because we worked together on a couple of stories in which we outed, and you outed because you were showing how they weren't reporting the truth from Haiti. You outed, for instance, how the Associated Press was being fed by who?
By Voice of America.
And Voice of America reporter was also doubling. Get this, everybody, ladies and gentlemen, stand by. That the reporter for Voice America was also working for, what's that group, National Public Radio?
National Public Radio.
Then we discovered that the vice president of the president of NPR was the former president of Radio Free Europe.
Right. So there's all these connections. Listen, these guys through USAID as a cover. And we're seeing this unfold in Venezuela.
New York Times, I called her myself. Who is she using?
Are you talking about Lydia Polgar?
Lydia Polgar.
Goodness.
You know, I called her.
Polgar,
and what was the deal there?
Oh, good Lord.
All right. You know what? Hold on.
So much,
Hold on.
We're talking about mountains and decades of disinformation.
But the Associated Press, after you broke the story, they had to fire the reporter.
That's right.
They had to have a press conference.
No, she resigned.
Oh, she resigned. they couldn't work with her anymore because they were compromised. But I'm saying this now, folks. I'm saying this now, listeners, people who love alternative, radical, courageous, investigative reporting, like you've heard for the last 25 years from Kevin Pina. We're saying this is incredibly important, and this is what we want you to support. We are going to stay on. Kevin, believe me, he's going to be up for the next, 72 hours tracking what happens with these mercenaries. And he's going to come back here, and we're going to have more information, and we're going to be on the cutting edge, and we're going to do the job that a whistleblowing radio station and program does, which is to hold the powerful accountable. Now, listen, folks, I'm asking you to support just the content of what you heard today. We are in a fund drive. You can get, if you want, there's a new speech pack, a winter speech pack, with all the most recent speeches. You can get that for $150 contribution. Or you can just, for this hour, for the most devoted, and shall we say, perhaps among the poorest democratic revolutionaries in the world, the Haitian people fighting for years, for decades, for centuries. Am I exaggerating here?
Not at all.
for the right to self-determination. And they can't, and they get crushed by the United States. The United States of America spends more money on one aircraft carrier than they do in the history of Haiti.
It's incredible.
And the what they go in, they still go in there today. Your story, the United States government still in there shooting at Democratic resistance to a corrupt government. By the way, corruption which you broke all along, Kevin, as it was happening. So this is, you know...
By the way, caught a lot of flack for it.
Oh.
I was calling the PHTK as corrupt, as you know, years ago.
When everybody thought they were the liberals. But this is what I'm asking people. We got a $1,000 match. And I'm asking people who believe in investigative reporting, who want us to, in the deepest of ways, in this context of important foreign policy, who want us to take these stories on, I'm asking for people who love the information, who want us to be free to continue being this whistleblowing radio show called Flashpoints. We need you to vote now. Believe me, people take note. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. I'm going to take note. I'm asking you to call because you believe in the content, that the premium, the real premium of this radio station and this show is content, is giving voice. You talk about giving voice to the voiceless, to the disinherited, to the disparaged, to the marginalized. That's what our founders here, 70 years of free speech radio, that's what our founders founded this network on. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. KPFA.org. Hit the pledge button. Join us. And I believe strongly, Kevin, that we carry on that mission, that we stand really in the tradition of the founders of Lou Hill with this kind of reporting that you and others bring to these microphones. So you've risked your life to tell this story repeatedly.
Well, you know, just so you know, when I received the photos of the passports of these Americans right after they were arrested from a contact in the Haitian police, I put them out on our Twitter feed, Haiti Information Project. They were retweeted by Flashpoints News. If you guys want to also follow Flashpoints News Radio on Twitter as well. And almost immediately, I got threats. You better take those tweets down, right? Didn't know who they were. There were anonymous threats coming over Twitter because they didn't want the information, the identities revealed of these Americans who were caught red-handed in Haiti with heavy armaments, with drones, with sophisticated communication equipment, who clearly were being protected. And it was the PHTK party, by the way, you know, for the PHTK party saying that these guys were there to take them out. It's so funny because it was three PHTK high representatives of the PHTK party, the current president, Jovenel Moïse, his party, that tried to get them out immediately after they were held by the police. So it's joking. You know, it's a joke. These guys are not going to claim that they're the victims, right?
I'm told so far we don't have that first call. I'm asking people to honor the work. So here's the, I didn't give out the number. That's my fault. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. You can also get, if you want, we have put together our Border Wars Flashpoints in Tucson, 6 hours of frontline reporting and UN testimony. You can get that for $100 contribution. You can get the MP3 CD KPF 2019 Winter Speech Pack for $150. You can get them both. I'm sure they'll give you a bargain if you get them both together. But really what we're asking you to do today, this is original investigative reporting about one of the most oppressed peoples in the world.
and they're being oppressed by folks in the United States who are financing the militaries. This is a U.S. oppression of a people that have been fighting for self-determination for too many years. And this is what we do. I'm going to give it to Kevin, but I need you to honor Kevin's work. I need you to start calling. I want you to let us send a message to the powers that be that this kind of original reporting that you're hearing today in the context of Kevin being here is what you care about, that that's what you believe we're about, that you do believe that this radio station, that we are the canaries in the coal mine of corporate disinformation. This story is one of those big lies coming through the corporate media.
Just to remind you, we have a $1,000 match.
Oh, that's right.
We need you to call us right now. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732 or 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Or you can also donate online. Go online. Go to www.kpfa.org and go ahead and push that button. Show us that this is show and the information we're giving you makes a difference. I got to tell you, Dennis, that sometimes I get scared with some of the stories that I report. Yeah. And some of the, it's scary. I get personally frightened no matter how much I've been through. And I've been through a lot. I still get frightened. And you know, one of the things that keeps me going, that helps me through that fear, is our listeners. Knowing that I know that when I take to this mic, they've got our back. Knowing that they appreciate what we're doing. Knowing that they're listening. And if anything happens to you or to me, they're there. And we can count on them. Why? Because we're a community working together for truth-telling. Right? This is not about corporate media that hides the truth, that obfuscates what's really being done in our name with our tax dollars. This is about us exposing the reality behind U.S. foreign policy. This is about ripping the veil off of power and making it naked so that we can see how false and how phony and how it doesn't really represent the interests of us here in this country. And that's what this show does.
And this is a chance for many of you who I have agreed with over the years that aren't crazy about when we at KPFA necessarily sometimes become the left shoppers network. What we bring you today,
sorry,
the kind of information that we've been bringing you. How long have you been working with us on this, Kevin?
Oh, my God. Let's see. 1991. Oh, we're talking.
Yeah, we're almost
years,
from the beginning.
30 years almost.
That reminds me. The show, this is the 30th year. This is the 70th anniversary of Pacifica and the 30th anniversary of this
Flash
show.
Points.
We've been working with you for 25 years. We've been working with you on this Haiti story, breaking stories like the one that you've helped us break today. And this is, we're in a fun drive, and I chose, rather than play 45 minutes of a compelling speech or documentary, you know, Kevin, how important it was that I was been driving you crazy for days. You've been working on the story. You've been pushing me back because you've been digging on the story. So we waited until today to get it out so that we can have a full...
And look what happened. They released these American mercenaries, right?
They released these American mercenaries. But it's 547. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Online, kpfa.org.
Go to www.kpfa.org. But that's the easiest way, the quickest, the simplest way to support this program, to support this kind of programming on this radio station, KPFA 94.1 FM in Berkeley. Again, call 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. We are counting on you so that we can keep this show going, so that we can keep this kind of programming in your ear and on the air.
1-800-439-5732. to 1-800-439-5732. Online, kpfa.org, 1-800-439-5732. If you believe in the work we're doing, if you can just call because you care about this kind of reporting, that you want to stand, that you want to lock arms with the courageous people of Haiti who have been fighting for self-determination for a very long time. Kevin watched two coups in progress. I had an opportunity to actually go back to Haiti when Aristide was ultimately returned with much less power. But it was incredible to see that this man, the president, could walk through the streets of the poorest neighborhood. It's got to be among the poorest neighborhoods in the world, City Soleil, to walk, to be there, to take the program there in 1994, to walk through the streets of City Soleil with Aristide, with no guards, with nobody in the way between him and the poorest people in the world, and the celebration and the tears and the cheers and the power. And this is the person that the United States government took out of the country in 2004 on leap year. Well, on February 29th, so it took another 4 years to have the exact day that people could protest on.
Well, you know, it's interesting because all these people who were haters who, you know, really just did character assassination of that poor man.
Do you know any
dictator tyrant who returns to his country and devotes the rest of his life to educating doctors, lawyers, and nurses
for social justice
in their country at the University UNIFA, the University of Aristide? Foundation of Aristide. And yeah, I don't know any other tyrant, as they claim that he was, or dictator who's ever done that in any country that I know of historically.
This is the big lie perpetuated by the corporate
press.
Which
we've also exposed here on this show, which we've taken on, you know, straight on in the show. We don't let them get away with lying. We come up with real facts that expose the lies, that shows the complicity, the collusion, if you want to use that word, between the corporate media, because remember, these guys are about the profit and the bottom line. We're not. We're about information. They're about profit and the bottom line, so we can speak truth to power, so we can expose when they're complicit in merely repeating lies at the State Department, which they're doing in Venezuela, by the way. Haiti gets very little attention because that's a U.S.-backed government. Venezuela gets all the attention because they're trying to create a U.S.-backed government there.
That's amazing. That's another huge story that we have been on. We have been all over in terms of the real story behind Venezuela. Right now, the real story here is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Well, this is an appeal to the folks that listen to this show that believe in investigative reporting and don't necessarily need a thank you gift. You can get our 6-hour Border Wars Flashpoints in Tucson special for $100 contribution. You can get the MP3 CD KPFA 2019 Winter Speech Pack for $150. I'm sure you can get them both for $200 or $225 or something like that.
Sure.
APFA.org. Hit the pledge button and support investigative reporting.
It's a $1,000 match.
$1,000 match. Every dollar you give is doubled. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. If you believe in investigative reporting, you can get our CD Border Wars. That's Flashpoints in Tucson. 6 hours of frontline reporting and UN testimony. $100 contribution. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. You can get the Winter Speech Pack for $150. That includes Dar Jamil, Antonio Uez, Robert Reich, Vandana Shiva, and a whole bunch of others. You can get that for $150 contribution. Get them
both for, I think, $225. Whatever it is, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Our spirits are up. Our heart is cooking. It's kpfa.org. That is working. You can pledge online.
Wow, we got to make $2,000. Right. That means we got to make $1,500.
We need that's a good start.
Got 6 minutes.
It's 5:54. We got 6 minutes. We're at 17, so we need $1,300.
Mm-hmm.
And we need it now. We need it. By the way, if we're going to get credit for raising this money, folks, you need to call now. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. And I love you. Call around the clock. But if you want to support Flashpoints, if you want to vote for this show,
now
is the time. But lots of people think, well, if I call later, well, we want you to call now and later. But if you want to support Flashpoints, if you want to send a message to the powers that be, that expensive investigative reporting, I have to admit, the station kicked in for money so that we could go to Tucson and do this kind of reporting. I'd like to pay them back. Is there anybody out there? That trip, the Flashpoints team spent about $3,000 to do that Tucson trip. We kept it cheap. We were all over the place. We had five people in one room. Can you help us pay for the trip? The trip was a couple of $1,000. I'd like to make it back. It's 5:55 now. Is there a couple of people out there with 200 or 500 or $1,000? $1,000 to match the $1,000 match. How about that? 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Online, kpfa.org. Kevin, six people online.
Just imagine what the airwaves would sound like in the Bay Area. But also remember, this show goes out to at least 40 other stations through the Pacifica Network and affiliates. So imagine what the radio waves would sound like without Flashpoints. You know the difference that this kind of programming makes in your lives. You know that you're going to hear something different here that tells you the part of the story, the side of the story that's being left out, that's being uncovered, that's being unreported in the mainstream news, the side of the story that is critical for us to make real decisions about our lives and our futures. That's the kind of difference
reporting
that we at Flashpoints like to make.
Reporting with context.
That's right.
Reporting
we
with context.
We don't just superficially cover
and history
things.
Behind it. Background, context, history, everything the corporate press hates. 1-800-439-5732. We are running out of time. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Online, kpfa.org. We have a $3,000 goal. We have a $1,000 match, and we are asking you to pledge in support of investigative reporting. 1-800-439-5732. How many people we have on the line there? Six people on the line. 1-800 at 5:57. Six people on the line, and we're trying to make $3,000. 1-800-439-5732. Border Wars, that's the Flashpoint 6-hour frontline reporting, and you went testimony from Tucson, $100 contribution. You can get the MP3 CD KPFA Winter Speech Pack, $150. Get them both for $2.25 or something like that. We need your help. 1-800-439-5732. Kevin, what can we say? Can you say it in 30 seconds?
Keep the lights on. Keep the truth coming. Let's never give up. This show is never going to give up. We're always going to do our best to bring you that side of the story you're not going to hear anywhere else. Thanks for your support. Again, call us at 1-800-439-5732. Give now. Show us that we are a community and that this kind of programming is valuable to us and our community.
1-800-439-5732. Kevin, thanks for today's report.
all those reports from the ground. Some of the most extraordinary reporting happened when you were facing off with UN troops that were clearly the...
You know, I can't listen to some of that stuff. I literally broke out in sweats when I listened to me back then, the stuff that was going on.
I think people understood how much danger you were in. It was clear to me that, you know, when you're looking down the barrel of a loaded gun and you're calling them out in the streets of Haiti and the tensions are high and they're really, and they're saying terrible things to you and your name's already been mentioned on Death Squad Radio, you know, there's a lot at stake.
Well, but that experience also informs my reporting for this show.
All right. Well, right now I'm going to inform the listenership that they got 30 seconds. And how much do we have here? 1950. How many calls waiting that we're not going to get credit for? 1-800-439-5732. You got to call now. 1-800-439-5732. Give it a shot. You can do it online, kpfa.org. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. KPFA.org. Hit the pledge button. Join us. 1-800-439-5732.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Noam Chomsky returns with some little-known facts and sane suggestions. He talks on the trumped-up crises in North Korea and Iran and the real disaster of Syria. I hope you'll stay tuned. Noam Chomsky spoke at length on April 24, 2017, in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Amy Goodman played the role of interviewer. Goodman is a very good interviewer, and one of her several interviewing skills is knowing when not to interrupt and just let the guy talk, which is pretty much all the time when the guy talking is Noam Chomsky. Ask Chomsky a question about public affairs, and he will respond with a long, brilliant, complex, impeccably organized, and pretty persuasive mini-lecture, topped with occasional splashes of dry, ironic humor, delivered absolutely deadpan. You have to listen carefully to get the deadpan irony, but you should be listening carefully in any case. We heard a bit of Chomsky's talk on last week's show, when he explained why the Republican Party is the most dangerous organization in the history of the world. Strong words, but he made a pretty good case. And of course, he was talking about climate change. Today, Chomsky talks about the trumped-up foreign crises in North Korea and Iran, and the real foreign disaster in Syria. Let's start with North Korea. This part is full of facts that at least I hadn't heard before. For example, the several times North Korea has agreed to dismantle its atomic bomb program, only to have the United States sabotage the agreement afterwards. Probably you didn't know much about the massive, serious war crimes the U.S. committed in North Korea during the Korean War, either. Betcha the History Channel didn't have a special on that. One of the great things about a Chomsky talk is that it's full of specific facts that are publicly available, but that somehow nobody else ever seemed to mention. Let's get on to the talk today. Amy Goodman asks if Trump's very aggressive stance against North Korea and Iran was taken mainly to boost his sagging popularity at home.
General McMaster, the National Security Advisor, saying tensions with North Korea are coming to a head. Do you think there is a possibility that the U.S. would attack North Korea?
This administration is extremely unpredictable. Trump probably has no idea what he's going to do 5 minutes from now. So you can't really make predictions with much confidence, but I doubt it very much. The reason is very simple. An attack on North Korea would unleash, no matter what attack it is, even a nuclear attack, would unleash massive artillery bombardment of Seoul, which is the biggest city in South Korea right near the border, which would wipe it out, including plenty of American troops. I'm no technical expert, but as far as I can, as I read and can see, there's no defense against that. Furthermore, North Korea could retaliate against American bases in the region where there's plenty of American soldiers and so on, also in Japan. They'd be devastated. North Korea would be finished, you know, so would much of the region. But if attacked, presumably they would respond, very likely. In fact, the responses might be automatic. McMaster, at least, and Mattis understand this, how much influence they have, we don't know. So I think an attack is unlikely. But the real question is there a way of dealing with the problem? There are a lot of proposals, sanctions, a new missile defense system, which is a major threat to China. It'll increase tensions there, military threats of various kinds, sending an aircraft carrier, the Vinson, to North Korea, except by accident. It happened to be going in the opposite direction, but we'll forget that. Those are the proposals, that kind of proposals as to how to solve it. Actually, there's one proposal that's ignored. I mean, you see a mention of it now and then. It's a pretty simple proposal. Remember, the goal is to get North Korea to freeze its weapons and missile systems. So one proposal is to accept their offer to do that. Sounds simple. They've made a proposal, China and North Korea, propose to freeze the North Korean missile and nuclear weapon systems, and the U.S. instantly rejected it. And you can't blame that on Trump. Obama did the same thing a couple of years ago. Same offer was presented, I think it was 2015, the Obama administration instantly rejected it. And the reason is that it calls for a quid pro quo. It says, in return, the United States should put an end to threatening military maneuvers on North Korea's borders, which happened to include, under Trump, sending of nuclear-capable B-52s flying right near the border. Now, maybe Americans don't remember very well, but North Koreans have a memory of not too long ago when North Korea was absolutely flattened, literally, by American bombing. There was literally no targets left. And I really urge people who haven't done it to read the official American military histories, the Air Quarterly Review, the military histories describing this. They describe it very vividly and accurately. They say there just weren't any targets left. So what could we do? Well, we decided to attack the dams, the huge dams. That's a major war crime. People were hanged for it at Nuremberg, but put that aside. And then comes an ecstatic, gleeful description of the bombing of the dams and the huge flow of water, which was wiping out valleys and destroying the rice crop on which Asians depend for survival. Lots of racist comment. But all with exultation and glee. You really have to read it to appreciate it. The North Koreans don't have to bother reading it. They lived it. So when nuclear-capable B-52s are flying on their border, along with other threatening military maneuvers, they're kind of upset about it. Strange people. And they continue to develop what they see as a potential deterrent that might protect the regime from, and the country, in fact, from destruction. This has nothing at all to do with what you think about the government. So maybe it's the worst government in human history. Okay. But these are still the facts that exist. So why is the United States unwilling to accept an agreement which would end the immediate threats of destruction against North Korea and in return freeze the weapons and missile systems? Well, I leave that to you, and remember that's bipartisan in this case. The usual argument is, well, you can't trust them and so on and so forth. But there is a history, and there's no time to run through the history. It's quite interesting. It begins in 1993 when the North Koreans made a deal with Israel to terminate North Korean missile shipments to the Middle East, which is a great serious threat to Israel and the world. And in return, Israel would recognize North Korea. The Clinton administration wouldn't accept that. They pressured Israel, which has to do with they're told, to withdraw from it. And North Korea responded by firing their first intermediate-range missiles. I won't go on with the rest. It's a very interesting story. There was actually an agreement in 2005 that North Korea would completely dismantle its nuclear weapons and missile systems, end them, finish, dismantle them, in return for a non-aggression pact from the United States, an end to threats, provision by the West, that means by the United States, of a light water reactor, which can't produce nuclear weapons, but could produce, be used for peaceful purposes, research, medical, other purposes. And that was basically the agreement, 2005. Didn't last very long. The Bush administration instantly undermined it. It dismantled the consortium that was supposed to provide the reactor, and it immediately imposed pressured, and it, when the U.S. pressures, it means it happens, banks to block North Korean financial transactions, including perfectly legitimate trade. So the crazy North Koreans started producing missiles and nuclear weapons again. And that's been the kind of record all the way through. So, yeah, maybe the most horrible regime in human history, but the fact of the matter is the regime does want to survive, and it even wants to carry out economic development. There's pretty general agreement about this, which it cannot do at any significant way when it's pouring resources, very scarce resources, into weapons and missile production. So they have considerable incentive, including survival, to perhaps continue this process of reacting in a kind of tit-for-tat fashion to U.S. actions. When the U.S. lowers tensions, they do. When we raise tensions, they go on with these plans. How about that as a possibility? I mean, it is, if you look at the press, it's occasionally mentioned. Actually, it was not a bad article in the Washington Post about it recently by a U.S. professor who teaches in South Korea. So occasionally it's this strange possibility of letting the North Koreans do exactly what we want them to do. Sometimes this is mentioned, but it's pretty much dismissed. We can't do that sort of thing. There are similar questions to raise about Iran. So Iran is, adults in the room, like Mattis and so on, say it's the greatest threat to peace, you know, the greatest sponsor of terrorism, on and on. How is it a sponsor of terrorism? Well, could go through that. So, for example, in Yemen, it's claimed that they are providing some aid to rebel tribesmen, Houthi tribesmen. Okay, maybe they are. What is the United States doing in Yemen? It's providing a huge flood of arms to its Saudi Arabian ally who are destroying the country, who've created a huge humanitarian crisis. Huge numbers of people killed, massive starvation, but Iran is the major source of terrorism. And if you look around the world, there's many questions like this. I don't want to go on too long, but there's one lesson that you discover when you carefully look at the historical record. And what I just described about North Korea is pretty typical. Over and over again, there are possibilities of diplomacy and negotiation which might not succeed. You can't be sure if you don't try them, but which look pretty promising, which are abandoned, dismissed, literally without comment, in favor of increased force and violence. In fact, that's also the background for the 1953 moment when the clock moved to 2 minutes to midnight and the U.S. faced the first serious threat to its security since probably the War of 1812, could have been avoided. There's pretty good evidence that it could have been avoided, but it was the possibility was literally not even considered. And case after case is like this. It's worth looking at the historical record from that perspective to ask whether that general comment has some validity. I think if you do, you'll find that it has considerable merit.
We are listening to Noam Chomsky in a public talk in Cambridge on April 24, responding to questions from Amy Goodman. We now turn to the poison gas attack by somebody in Syria and the U.S.'s immediate response, firing off 59 Tomahawk missiles. What to make of this bloody situation? Back to Noam Chomsky.
I last interviewed you on April 4th, just a few weeks ago on Democracy Now! It was the 50th anniversary of Dr. King giving his Beyond Vietnam speech, Why He Opposed the War in Vietnam, where he called the U.S. the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. And I wanted to turn from North Korea and Iran to Syria. It was the day of the gas attack in Syria, so we didn't get to talk about it very much. And I'm wondering your thoughts on what you think happened and then the ensuing U.S. bombing that President Trump would later talk about, saying he was having chocolate cake with the Chinese president, very, very good chocolate cake, when they launched the Tomahawk missiles into Iraq, he said, and he was corrected by the interviewer, right, who said it was actually
Bunch
Syria.
Of ragheads. It's all about the same. But, well, there are some things we know for sure. There was a serious chemical weapons attack. Nobody doubts that. It's plausible that it was the Syrian government, which does raise some questions. It's not so obvious why the Assad regime would have carried out a chemical warfare attack at a moment when it's pretty much winning the war. And the worst danger it faces is that a counter force will enter to undermine its progress. So it does raise some questions. Even though maybe you can think up some reason why the Assad regime, which is a murderous, brutal regime, might have done it. There's even another question as to why the Russians would have allowed it. Remember, this is the air base is a joint Russian-Syrian base. Russia has plenty of clout in Syria. And for them, it's a total disaster. Now, they have global concerns, not just local concerns in Syria. The White House did put out a justification, an intelligence report to explain and account for showing why they had absolute confidence that it was a Syrian government attack. Now, this was analyzed closely by a very serious and credible analyst, Theodore Postol, professor at MIT, who has a long record of highly successful, credible analysis. He's a highly regarded strategic analyst and intelligence analyst. And he gave a pretty devastating critique of the White House report. You can pick it up online and take a look at it. So there certainly are some questions that Syria is capable of a monstrous act like that, the Syrian government, that much is not in doubt. But one question that arises is, before doing something, could you find out what happened? Okay? I mean, let's have an inquiry, take a look and see what in fact actually happened. Now, there are plenty of cases where it looked as though things happened, but they didn't. And remember that reporting from Syria is extremely difficult. If reporters go into the rebel-held areas and don't do what they're told, you know, get your head cut off. Patrick Coburn and others have written about this. You just can't seriously report from those areas. There are obvious questions when you're reporting from the government side. So the reporters are, there are very good reporters doing a serious, courageous job, but there's not much you can do. So we just don't know a lot. Those are the circumstances in which the 59 Tomahawk missiles were launched. That's pretty easy. It's easy to sit in Washington and push a button and say, go kill somebody. That's considered courage, you know, man, macho, showing how strong we are. What did they actually do? Well, apparently the Tomahawk missiles were targeting a part of the airfield that doesn't seem to be used. And in fact, the next day, planes were taking off. And in fact, the village that was attacked by the chemical weapons has been even more heavily attacked by straight bombing from the Assad government after the 59 Tomahawk missiles. So whatever they were intended to do doesn't seem to have anything to do with Syria. I suspect that what they were intended to do was pretty much what you described, to shore up Trump's image, as I think it was Nikki Haley at the UN said, there's a new sheriff in town. So now we've got Wyatt Earp, you know, pulling out his gun and getting rid of the bad guys, no more of this soft stuff. So it was probably an attempt to shore up that image, pretty much like the bomb in Afghanistan. Nobody knows what it was for, what it had to do with. Probably destroyed a large part of Afghanistan. Shortly after that, there was an incredibly brutal and successful Taliban attack, which killed a couple hundred recruits, most of them unarmed, young draftees, didn't know what they were doing. It was so bad that the defense minister resigned. Doesn't seem to have any effect on. It was supposedly aimed at ISIS. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. They don't seem to be affected by it. There doesn't seem to be any strategic analysis behind any of these actions, as far as anyone can tell. They seem like kind of about at the level of the Twitters that keep coming out. Something that kind of occurs to me, so why not do it? It's cheap. It may kill a lot of people, makes me look good, you know, makes it seem as if I'm defending the country, and so on. It's hard to see it as anything but that. That these things help the people of Syria and Iraq is very hard to imagine.
What do you think has to be done to solve the crisis, the humanitarian catastrophe
in Syria? It's a terrible catastrophe. And, you know, unfortunately, there isn't a lot that can be done about it. There are some things that can be done. I mean, the idea that you can send in the Marines and bomb and so on, that has a small problem. If you do, you probably set off a nuclear war. And not only is Syria destroyed, the rest of Syria, but the rest of the world too. So there's a little difficulty in that scenario, whatever one thinks about the justification for it. So what can be done? Well, one thing that can be done, which is really easy, very easy, is to take care of the people fleeing from this disaster. I mean, there are huge numbers of people fleeing from the disaster. What do we do about them? Make sure they don't come here, you know, kind of like people fleeing from, you know, my relatives, in fact, trying to flee from Eastern Europe and before when the Nazis were coming along. We don't want them, not here, you know. So the Syrians don't come, maybe a tiny trickle, but Very few come here. Europe's not that much better. In fact, pretty horrible, too. So one thing you could do is just take care of the people who are fleeing the disaster. Another thing you can do is provide humanitarian aid for those in the region. Now, there are countries who are absorbing refugees, remember. Like, take Lebanon. It's not a rich country like us, poor country. About 40% of the population are refugees, many of them fleeing from the Israeli wars as far back as 48. Many, a huge number of Syrians. Jordan, another poor country, has absorbed a huge number of refugees. Turkey has a couple of million. Iran has accepted refugees. There are poor countries that are accommodating refugees, but not the rich countries. The rich countries, it's not our business, certainly not us. So another thing you'd do is provide badly needed aid and assistance for those who have succeeded in fleeing the disaster or who remain in parts of Syria where survival is possible but are living under horrible conditions. Now, that's all cheap and easy. Tiny fraction of increasing the military budget to cause more destruction. Now, the other thing that can be done and is being done is to try to support local efforts throughout Syria at local ceasefires just to lower the level of violence. Now, that's happening in different places. Yeah, maybe the people don't like each other, but people sometimes like to survive. And there are accommodations worked out, and they could be helped. A broader possibility is to try to pursue the negotiations that will lead to some kind of diplomatic settlement. Now, there have been efforts, but they're mixed. And they're probably, we can't be certain, but there seem to be possibilities that were dismissed. There are things that could be done, not what we would like to see. You know, it'd be nice to see here's a solution that'll make everybody happy and end the destruction. But those just don't seem on the possible agenda because for all kind of reasons, including the threat of very serious war if Russia and the United States don't act in a high level of concert in pursuing whatever they may be doing.
Noam Chomsky, speaking in Cambridge, Massachusetts, on April 24, 2017. Thanks again to Boston's Chuck Rosina, who recorded the talk and made it available to us. And thank you again for listening to New World Notes. We come to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. Find a free archive of our shows at our website, which remains newworldnotes.blogspot.com. On behalf of the entire New World Notes staff, that's me, myself, and our human relations manager, Bill O'Reilly. On behalf of our entire staff, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimi non carborundum. War is not healthy for children and other living things. Try to live each day as though the truth were true, and please come back again next week. Ciao.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap. Listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
Listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl.
President Trump recently said this.
We've been fighting for a long time in Syria. I've been president for almost 2 years, and we've really stepped it up. And we have won against ISIS. We've beaten them, and we've beaten them badly. We've taken back the land, and now it's time for our troops to come back home.
As I've stated on previous shows, it's very difficult to understand what's going on in Syria, the Middle East, and in the global war on terror in general without some understanding of 9/11 and the globalist wish for a new world order with everything under their control. 9/11 brought about permanent war, and there's extensive research that shows that 9/11 was not carried out by Osama bin Laden and the 19 guys with box cutters. The evidence points to elements of our own U.S. government and the neocons with close ties to Israel and Israel itself, with Pakistan and Saudi Arabia as minor players. The wars since 9/11 were planned well in advance of 9/11, but a new Pearl Harbor was needed to get the American people to support these wars. Here's what General Wesley Clark revealed about the 9/11 wars.
About 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the joint staff who had used to work for me. And one of the generals called me and he said, "Sir, you got to come in. You got to come in and talk to me a second." I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, No. He says, "We've made the decision. We're going to war with Iraq." This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, "We're going to war with Iraq. Why?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "I guess they don't know what else to do." So I said, "Well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to Al-Qaeda?" He said, no. He says, "There's nothing new that way. They just made the decision to go to war with Iraq." He said, "I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we've got a good military and we can take down governments." And he said, "I guess if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem has to look like a nail." So I came back to see him a few weeks later. And by that time, we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, "Are we still going to war with Iraq?" And he said, "Oh, it's worse than that." He said, he reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper. And he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office today. And he said, "This is a memo that describes how we're going to take out 7 countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran."
But what President Trump and General Wesley Clark both failed to mention is that the CIA created and supported Al-Qaeda and worked with Osama bin Laden. They can move them into any country they want as a pretext to attack that country under the guise of fighting the terrorists. And this is exactly what's been going on in Syria. But first, let's listen to Michelle Trusadovsky setting the stage for where we're at today.
For the opportunity to address this important subject of September 11 and also establish the links between the so-called war on terrorism and the issues underlying the process of globalization. We are not dealing with separate realities. We are dealing with the interface between war and the conquest of economic frontiers through the application of these deadly IMF World Bank reforms, which have characterized the international scene for the last 20 years and which have led to economic and social devastation throughout the developing countries, but also in most of the developed countries where similar reforms under the auspices of national governments and financial markets have also been applied. So we must understand war and globalization are intricately related, and war is the structural adjustment of last resort. It destroys institutions, it kills people, and ultimately it is an instrument of economic conquest. We must understand the events of September 11. The war on terrorism is a fabrication from A to Z. We have piles of documents which prove unequivocally that this is not a war on terrorism, but it is a war of conquest, which is marked by the extension of America's sphere of influence into Central Asia. This war has been long in the making, in the planning stages. September 11 is a pretext for waging war on the grounds that one has to go after Osama bin Laden. Now, we have to also understand that in the wake of 9/11, we are perhaps facing the most serious crisis in modern history. It is not only marked by the collapse of living standards all over the world, which are the consequence precisely of the neoliberal reforms applied universally and which have impoverished millions of people. And this poverty is not the result of any scarcity of resources, quite the opposite. The system has unlimited capacity to produce, yet the very process of its expansion worldwide leads to essentially impoverishing people by minimizing employment and by minimizing wages and so on. And the war on terrorism is in fact the counterpart of this process. It supports the process of globalization. It destroys national sovereignties and it extends the American empire into new frontiers. Let me say a few words. This is well documented that Osama bin Laden is a creation of the CIA. In fact, nobody actually denies that. What they say is Osama is a creation of the CIA and he went against us. Now, believe it or not, he went against us. We helped this guy back in the early 80s. We helped him. We brought the Mujahideen. We set up the madrasas. We had the training camps. We put in place the Pakistan Inter-Services Intelligence, which was there to help Osama, and so on and so forth. All this is documented in many, many books and articles. But the question which I'd like to address now, the CIA says, Osama went against us. This is a blowback. They call it a blowback. In intelligence jargon, it means that an intelligence asset goes against the sponsors. Okay? That's a blowback. We helped Osama and he's now turned against Uncle Sam. Well, I can tell you that that is simply not true. And I will present the evidence to you that Osama bin Laden is still an intelligence asset of the U.S. government. His al-Qaeda has collaborated with successive U.S. administrations, including Bush, including Clinton and Bush Jr. And you might be interested to know that in July, 2 months before September 11, Osama bin Laden was hospitalized in this beautiful American hospital in Dubai. And he was receiving treatment for his kidney problems, which he had caught while sitting in damp caves in Afghanistan. But in any event, this is based on a report published in the French daily Le Figaro, which is one of France's largest newspapers. During his 15-day stay in the hospital, he was visited by the CIA head of station in the United Arab Emirates. and there was no attempt made to either arrest him or deport him. He was given treatment in a hospital which was connected or tied to the U.S. Embassy in the United Arab Emirates. If you go to the embassy's homepage, you'll find the telephone number of the hospital where Osama was treated. And incidentally, here is the CIA visiting Osama on his hospital bed while he's recovering from his kidney problems. And incidentally, on the 10th of September, Osama bin Laden was back in hospital in Rawalpindi, in a military hospital in Rawalpindi. Anybody who has been to Rawalpindi knows that the place, it's the headquarters of the Pakistani military. It's swarming with U.S. military advisors. The U.S. military mission is close by. It is impossible that Osama bin Laden could have been hospitalized on the 10th of September. I don't know when he was released. The report doesn't say. But everybody knew in the high ranks of the Pakistani military and the U.S. military that he was in hospital in Rawalpindi. And the source of this information, which has not been refuted, I love mainstream sources, Dan Rather, CBS News. Now, Dan Rather, CBS News, goes to Rawalpindi and interviews a number of people about this, and then it's broadcast. Of course, everybody says it's not relevant. Of course it's relevant. Of course. In other words, we have to connect the dots. If, in fact, he was hospitalized in Dubai and hospitalized again in Rawalpindi, and he has a kidney problem, and he was never arrested, and if Donald Rumsfeld says we will have to use nuclear weapons to go after him, obviously there's somebody is lying somewhere, right? Because, and I have the quotes from Donald Rumsfeld saying that they will use nuclear weapons against Osama. Now, if in effect they had been interested at all in arresting him, they would have done it, but they didn't. And the fact of the matter is that Al-Qaeda network, which was created by the CIA in 79 and which gained prominence throughout the 80s, alongside the development of Pakistan's military intelligence apparatus, which was also supported by the CIA, all this was a process which was supposed to be against the Soviet Union at the time, to have the Mujahideen fight on behalf of Uncle Sam. Of course, they didn't necessarily know they were fighting on behalf of Uncle Sam, because intelligence assets act wittingly or unwittingly in relation to their sponsors. That's the nature of an intelligence operation. But bear in mind that in the wake of the Cold War, none of this infrastructure was disbanded. Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda continued, the links with Pakistan's inter-services intelligence continued, and the links to agencies of the U.S. government continued as well. I will give you documentary evidence of that statement. Essentially, what you have is the following. The ISI historically has played as the institutional base for channeling support to Islamic insurgencies in different parts of the world, but particularly in the former Soviet Union, the Balkans, the Middle East, but also in other regions. And Pakistan's inter-services intelligence is a vast bureaucratic military apparatus which was set up with the support of the CIA in the early 80s. It was set up under the government of General ضیاء-الحق Haq in the early 80s. It developed into a vast network of agents, but also it had a military component, and it supported both Osama bin Laden, but also the Taliban. And bear in mind, the Taliban were supported by the United States. They were always supported by the United States. They would never have been able to form a government in 1996 had it not been for the support of Pakistan's inter-services intelligence and the Pakistan military, as well as military aid which was channeled using Pakistan's ISI as a go-between to the Taliban and to Osama. In summer of 2001, the ISI chief, General Mahmoud Atta, transferred $100,000 to the ringleader of 9/11. Now understand that the ISI has also very close links with the CIA. This information is confirmed by a number of reports, including an FBI report, which points to the transfer of money but doesn't identify the name of the individual who is behind the transfer. But it then it's confirmed by Agence France-Presse and the Times of India and an Indian intelligence report that it was the ISI which transferred this money to the ringleader of 9/11. Now, curiously and incidentally, the FBI report, which was quoted by an ABC News story in late September, talks about the money man behind the terrorists. The money man, the architect, I'm using their terms, the money man, the architect behind 9/11. Now, the money man behind 9/11 is Mahmoud Ahmad, head of the ISI, not necessarily as an individual, but as the chief of an organization which is closely in liaison with the CIA. Now, these reports are unequivocal because they're based, again, on the FBI. The FBI says very textually, you can read it in our magazine, because we've reproduced these quotes, that they can trace the money trail. They know who is behind it. And in fact, subsequent reports say it's Mahmoud Ahmad. Now, Mahmoud Ahmad arrives in the United States on the 4th of September. Now, is this event related or unrelated to 9/11? I think it is. He arrives on the 4th, and the press briefings say General Mahmoud is here on a routine visit of consultations with his U.S. counterparts. Now, who are his U.S. counterparts? George Tenet of the CIA, the Richard Armitage in the State Department, Mark Grossman, and so on and so forth. I mean, these are his counterparts. He has top-level meetings with these individuals in the course of his week-long consultation. But more importantly, in the wake of 9/11, he also meets up with U.S. officials to discuss the cooperation of Pakistan in the war on terrorism. So that what you have here, essentially, is the money man behind 9/11, according to FBI reports, on an official visit, given red carpet treatment in Washington, with meetings at the State Department, at the White House, at the Pentagon, and the CIA, and in the wake of 9/11, Mahmoud Ahmad comes on the 4th. He has meetings with his U.S. counterparts. On the 11th of September, there are several meetings of the National Security Council, which the first one takes place actually by video telephone from Offutt Air Force Base, where President Bush had been taken. The other members of the National Security Council are in Washington. And at that meeting, George Tenet essentially feeds the assumptions to President Bush that Osama bin Laden is behind the attacks, and Bush gives the green light to wage the war on terrorism. And then the final meeting is at 11 o'clock at night. It's a meeting of the War Cabinet where they agree on their strategy. What happens the following morning? They said, we're going to go after the terrorists, we're going to deploy all this military might. It was all decided in the evening of September 11. On September 12th in the morning, Richard Armitage, perhaps one of the most powerful members of the Bush administration, together with George Tenet and a couple of other people, Richard Armitage meets with Mahmoud Ahmad, the money man, the architect behind the 9/11 terrorists. And what is the subject matter of their meetings? Cooperation of the ISI in waging the war on terrorism. Doesn't that sound a little bit contradictory that the money man behind 9/11, and I'm quoting the FBI, would be invited to help the U.S. administration in going after Osama? Of course, Osama is an intelligence asset of the U.S. government, and so the whole issue, of course, is all the inconsistencies, I think, start to emerge. But there you are, the U.S. government signs, has an agreement which is then finalized a day later on the 13th, And General Mahmoud Ahmad states that they will cooperate in helping the U.S. administration in going after Osama bin Laden. It's a little bit like asking the devil to go after Dracula. Because, in fact, the terrorists in the 9/11, the terrorists were instruments, and they were instruments of a well-prepared intelligence operation which emanates out of Pakistan's inter-services intelligence. Now, if then the Bush administration asks Pakistan's inter-services intelligence to collaborate in the war on terrorism, when in fact the money man behind these terrorist attacks emanates from Pakistan's ISI, then I think we can safely infer, if we're looking at the proximity group of this individual. I mean, in my faculty of social sciences, I deal with sociologists and anthropologists who like to look at proximity groups. And if they looked at the proximity group of this individual, say, ah, he's a buddy of Mohammed Atta, but he's also a buddy of Richard Armitage, and he has a very close personal relationship with George Tenet. Okay? A very close personal relationship with George Tenet. And George Tenet has a very close personal relationship with the President of the United States. And that is fundamental in understanding how the military intelligence apparatus has in effect taken over the reins of government in the United States. The people who pull the strings, who are behind him, are the key individuals of the military intelligence apparatus. And behind those individuals, presumably, you have other brokers which belong to the financial and corporate establishment, which are also the oil companies, the banks, and so on, which certainly have links to the CIA. So this is the situation that we are in today. From my point of view, the foreknowledge is red herring. The foreknowledge issue is a red herring because, obviously, they knew. They keep track of their intelligence assets. If Osama bin Laden is an intelligence asset to this day, and the evidence proves it beyond doubt, then obviously the US government knows everything about Osama bin Laden, and it also points, although I don't want to necessarily draw, this is still a very complex process, but it does point at least to cover up, complicity and deception. Complicity of senior officials of the Bush administration, the fact that Richard Armitage meets up with the money man behind the terrorists, and so on. I think at least that should be investigated. That ultimately this is the only way to prevent what has been announced, which is a major military adventure which threatens the future of humanity. Thank you very much.
And again, you were just listening to Professor Michelle Chosudovsky of globalresearch.ca. And now this is what Stephen Gowans has to say in his book titled Washington's Long War on Syria. On behalf of Wall Street, the United States' most politically influential sector, successive U.S. governments waged a war on Arab nationalist Syria, not to support the spread of democracy, which Syria's Arab nationalists had developed to a far higher degree than had Washington's prized Arab allies, but to eliminate opposition to a Washington-led global economic order which prioritized the pursuit of profit above all other considerations. From 1963, Syrian governments in which Ba'ath Arab Socialist Party members Hafez al-Assad and his son Bashar played principal roles were committed to the Arab nationalist values of freedom from foreign domination and Arab socialism. Syria's secular Arab nationalist government forged alliances with the Islamic Republic of Iran, which likewise rejected integration into the U.S. superintended global economic order and valued economic and political independence. The values which the Assad-led Syrian government embraced were inimical to the U.S. foreign policy goal of creating highly favorable business climates for the U.S. corporations, bankers, and investors around the world. In place of pandering to Wall Street, Syrian Arab nationalists sought to free Syria, and as an ultimate goal, the entire world, from the political and economic agendas of foreign powers. In the spring of 2011, upheaval shook the Arab world. The distemper became known as the Arab Spring, Riots broke out in Syria in March 2011 and quickly turned into an insurgency. Washington almost immediately called for its old Arab nemesis, Bashar al-Assad, to step down. U.S. President Barack Obama declared that Assad had lost legitimacy, citing the armed rebellion as proof. Other countries Washington had opposed in the region, Iran, Gaddafi's Libya, and Saddam's Iraq, were, like Syria, committed to economic and political independence and state-directed development at odds with the paradigm favored by the U.S. State Department on behalf of U.S. banks, corporations, and investors. The United States' efforts to oust the government of Bashar al-Assad antedated the Arab Spring by many years, and Washington had had a hand in inciting the Muslim Brotherhood, which had a long history of violent antagonism toward the Syrian government, dating to 1963. Washington's motivation to topple Bashar al-Assad's government prior to 2011 was related to Damascus's embrace of anti-imperialist and anti-Zionist positions and its program of state-directed economic development. And again, that was from Stephen Gowan's book called Washington's Long War on Syria. ISIS and al-Nusra in Syria are nothing more than an evolved al-Qaeda, supported and controlled by the U.S. and its Western allies. And now here's Michelle Chusadovsky again to talk to you about that. And this comes from an interview on Press TV.
I think that those who accuse, in fact, have blood on their hands. NATO has blood on their hands. The United States has blood on their hands. Why? Because they have supported an armed insurgency back from the outset in March of 2011. It is known and documented that this so-called opposition is in fact a proxy military formation or paramilitary formation which is supported by the Western Military Alliance. We also know that there are special forces from NATO countries which have integrated this so-called opposition, namely the Free Syrian Army. We know that Turkey is supplying the so-called opposition with weapons, and this has been going on for several months. And we also have very well-documented evidence to the effect that most of the civilian casualties are attributable to terrorist acts by opposition gunmen and paramilitary. We must, I think, know who are the sides, okay? Because on the one hand, you have the government of Syria, and on the other, you have, in fact, the foot soldiers of NATO. This is a plan to destabilize Syria as a nation state. It's part of a broader military agenda, which has been ongoing for several years. And the United States and NATO have a broader military agenda. This isn't really an opposition. There's an opposition within Syria. This is a fabricated opposition. Many of the people, or the gunmen who are fighting, are in fact mercenaries from neighboring countries, in particular from Qatar, from Iraq. In other words, they're not even Syrian nationals. So this so-called opposition is made out in large part by terrorist brigades, which are covertly supported by the Gulf states, Qatar in particular, Saudi Arabia, but also the Western Military Alliance. They have been seeking, from the outset, regime change, and, in other words, toppling the government and destabilizing the country.
And here's what former U.S. diplomat Jim Douglas has to say about Syria on an interview with Scotty on RT. He's asked here about his thoughts on Trump's withdrawal of troops from Syria.
I think it is a big win for America. It's the right thing. It's long overdue, and I'm glad to see it. I hope it sticks. He certainly has the power, certainly has the legal authority. In fact, there's no legal basis for us to be in Syria at all. So he's on very strong ground if that's what he wants to do. The question is, will his underlings actually carry out his instructions, or will they try to sandbag him, make exceptions to it, slow roll him on the timetable? We'll still have some contractors there, et cetera, et cetera. I think one of the things that actually strengthens his hand, paradoxically, is the fact that the Turks are preparing to move into that area of Syria. And evidently, he did talk to President Erdogan recently. Maybe this gives him an excuse to do what he wants to do. I notice this tweet says, my priority has been defeating ISIS. he knows that's not the priority of the people he's appointed. I think there are a couple of things here. One is on the regime change thing. I'm sure that's what a lot of those people want, but they're in a very weak position to make that argument. The Assad government is not going anywhere. It is staying in power. You'd have to be, frankly, insane not to recognize that that is the case. What they're really there is, this is part of their strategy to try to have regime change in Tehran. It really has less to do with Syria than it does with Iran. The other thing, of course, is that on the question of ISIS, you're going to get this argument. Senator Lindsey Graham made this argument today that if we pull out, it will create a vacuum and we'll have a resurgence of ISIS just like we saw in Iraq when Obama pulled out of Iraq. That is such a baseless myth in terms of what is really going on. What is really allowing the opportunity for groups like ISIS, like Al-Qaeda, is the fact that outside powers are supporting them, have been supporting these terrorists to overthrow the Syrian government. And what we need is a reestablishment of the authority of the legal Syrian government.
So will the withdrawal of U.S. troops bring peace to Syria? Or will our proxy armies and our allies keep the assault on Assad going? This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
Building bridges. I'm Amy Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
In Brooklyn's Borum Hill, lines were moving slowly in the packed, drab, gray building. Jasmine Headley just wanted to get a voucher for city-funded daycare so she could find someone to look after her one-year-old son while she went to work as a cleaner. Instead, Headley, 23, ended up behind bars because sick and tired of being sick and tired, the young mother sat on the floor because there were no seats available in the crowded room. Next, Headley was lying on the floor, surrounded by New York City police officers and security guards, holding her one-year-old son firmly in her arms as the officers forcibly tried to yank the child away. "They're hurting my son," she screams again and again. One officer pulls out a stun gun. Headley was charged with resisting arrest, acting in a manner injurious to a child, obstructing government administration, and criminal trespass. Letitia James, now the New York State Attorney General, commented, No mother should have to experience such trauma and humiliation. Being poor is not a crime, but actually it is.
In Ferguson, Missouri, in addition to exposing racially biased policing, the Justice Department's Ferguson report exposed to the world a system of fines and fees levied for minor crimes that, what they proved too expensive for Ferguson's largely poor African-American population, resulted in jail sentences for thousands of people. Ferguson is everywhere in America today. Through money bail systems, fees and fines, strictly enforced laws and regulations against behavior, including trespassing and public urination that largely affect the homeless, and the substitution of prisons and jails for the mental hospitals that have traditionally served the impoverished. In one of the richest countries of the earth, we have effectively made it a crime to be poor.
We're building bridges to Professor Peter Edelman, who famously resigned from the administration of Bill Clinton over welfare reform, who discusses his new book, Not a Crime to be Poor. And Professor Edelman connects the dots between these policies and others, including school discipline in poor communities, child support policies affecting the poor, public housing ordinances, addiction treatment, and the spectra of public benefits fraud to paint a picture of a mean-spirited, retributive system that seals whole communities into inescapable cycles of poverty and then criminalizes the residents of of those communities.
But first, we go to a New York City Hall press conference protesting the arrest and jailing of Jasmine Headley. We hear first from City Council Speaker Corey Johnson and then Majority Leader Lori Gumbo.
Our Speaker of the City Council, Corey Johnson.
It is absolutely necessary that we gather here today. I felt immediately heartbroken for Ms. Headley and for her baby boy and furious at what I saw. But it shows what is wrong in our system. How disheartening it is to try and receive benefits for which you're entitled. How overflowing these offices are with people who need help. And how one incident can escalate so quickly that sends a young mother to jail and a child into ACS custody. We saw how our system criminalizes poverty and separates parents from children without considering the lasting damage that will occur to these parents and children. Anyone who saw it has an obligation to speak out and to make our system better, to fight for changes that will help families like Jasmine Headley's. I just heard our majority leader, Lori Gumbo, speak from the perspective of being a black woman with a 17-month-old black child, and to hear her speak so passionately, so emotionally, from the perspective of a black woman with a small baby, to me indicates the structural racism that is involved in our systems here in New York City, and the importance to acknowledge that. I will be meeting with the Department of Social Services Commissioner, Steve Banks, and the NYPD Commissioner, James O'Neill, to get to the bottom of this, to understand how this could have happened, and what we can do as a city to make sure that it never happens again. We also have an obligation to, of course, look at the big picture of what we're talking about, but to also immediately help Jasmine Headley and her baby. This should have never happened. She should be released from Rikers Island immediately and reunited with her one-year-old baby. Yeah. That is what should be done. Release her.
Release her now. Release her now.
And every,
release her now.
And every,
release her now.
Every leader in this city should be saying that.
Release her now. Release her now. Release her now.
Our majority leader, Lori Gumbo.
I woke up at 5 o'clock this morning and got my son ready because we had to go in front of HRA today to protest, send a message loud and clear that black women matter. Nobody understands how difficult it is to be a black woman in New York City, in America. As Malcolm X said, we are the most vulnerable. We are the most antagonized. We are the most neglected. We are the most disrespected in this entire country. And for that woman, our Jasmine Headley, yes, each one of us are her. I have a 16-month-old son, and I can't imagine, because I would have fought just as hard as she did to hold on to my son, yep, if that had happened to me.
Yep.
And some people, these trolls are saying, why didn't she just stand up?
No.
Why didn't someone offer her a seat?
A seat, that's right.
Treat people with dignity, with respect, that they matter, with humanity. And that's why we are out here today, of all races, of all nationalities, because we have to send a message loud and clear. Those officers made a calculated decision that by removing Jasmine from her son, waving around tasers, that there would be no repercussions. We are angry. We are mad as hell. We don't want some bogus investigation that's going to tell us we didn't see what we saw on the investigation on the video. We saw the video. Everybody saw the video, just like we saw the Eric Garner video. And we are not taking it anymore. We are fed up. We are going to keep out until Jasmine comes home and until those officers, they are fired. That's the least of what should happen. And we should not continue to victimize Jasmine. We have to send a message loud and clear. You do not attack black women. You do not attack any women in the city of New York. And that's where we stand as a council, and that's where we stand as a body. We have this can never happen again to another mother in the city of New York. Thank you.
Release her now. Release her now. Release her now. Release her now.
Well, we know that Jasmine Headley, through public pressure, was indeed released. But we're joined by Professor Peter Edelman, policymaker, law professor at Georgetown University Law Center. And as I said, there's few people who have the kind of expertise, fields of poverty, welfare, juvenile justice, and constitutional law, and has written an enormously important book, Not a Crime to Be Poor. And I should say, as a humble legal aid lawyer in the civil division, Professor Edelman, we're all eagerly waiting to hear the things that you have to say, because we face this every day, and that is the criminalization of poverty.
Well, here we are. I mean, this is so powerful. What a terrible thing Ms. Headley went through. And yeah, I hope it does have the effect that the people who came out and protested and makes a difference for the price that she has paid for this. It fortunately made so much attention that she was released and she's back with her child, and that's good. But this is everything that's wrong. Put it in a context. The largest group of people who live in poverty in our country are women and children. Higher than African American, higher than Latino, Native American. The largest group are women, and that includes, by the way, white women with children, very, very high, over 40%. That's just astonishing. And indeed, as the poverty's gone down a little bit, as the recession kind of has gone back, it hasn't gone back below 40%. So that's the heart of it. And the heart of the heart is that, bad as welfare was back in the days when there was a legal right to have it, and President Clinton came along and the Congress, and they passed TANF, the Temporary Assistance for Families. Now, we have gone down, just, and this connects to the 40%. The number of people who are now getting cash assistance in our country, we want jobs for people. We don't want people to have cash assistance unless they just can't find a job. And indeed, they can't find a job very often because they don't have child care. And that's what this was about Ms. Headley. Her child care had been cut off, and she didn't know why. Apparently just a computer glitch or something. And she came down there to get help. Well, you can't. You're a single mom, and you want to work. You've got to have child care. Well, she was doing it right, and they took it away from her. So that's the heart of that. When Clinton became president, we had 14.3 million people on cash assistance welfare. And I think that's too high because we really were not helping sufficiently for people to get jobs. It's now under 3 million people in the country. That's less than 1% of the population of the country. And we're talking about deep poverty here. Now, we now have 7 million people in this country whose only income is from a food stamp, is from SNAP, and that means less than $6,000 or about $6,000 a year for families of three. So that's what was done by TANF, and that has left us with over 15 million people whose incomes are less than half the poverty level, under $10,000 for a family of three. So this is the heart of the numbers, and it's national. And you know, here we are, you are in New York with this awful thing happens. And in fact, it's actually better than it is in other parts of the country, if you can believe that. I mean, we're down to the fact in states like Wyoming, Mississippi, Texas, big Texas, under the 5%, 5 out of 100 children living in low-income poverty families are getting TANF, are getting cash assistance. There was a right of it under a system that didn't work very well, but there was a legal right to it. There is not that anymore, and so we're down to under $3 million. So that's what we have, and it's in a context of racism, because who is hit by all of this? It's people of color, and of course women. So it's sexist as well. That's the larger story that goes with Jasmine Headley. Maybe I should stop there because there's a lot more to talk about.
No, actually don't. I think it's important that you continue the narrative, because the issue of poverty, and certainly the link between criminalization of poverty or because of poverty, is barely on the lips of the populace. And so flesh out for more the kind of details or how the Jasmine Headley's manifests itself in many other areas.
Two different things here. They certainly all connect into the criminalization of poverty. The one thing, it's the things that go with the story that we've talked about, Ms. Headley, which is just plain mean. And it doesn't have to do with money, which I want to talk about, money to get money into the coffers of states and cities and so on. But all these other things where we're just being mean. And that's true here. I mean, it isn't just that it's very hard to get TANF. You know, you go into the office anywhere in the country and you try to get TANF and SNAP and all of those things. And state after state, they line you up. You have to wait all day. They tell you to go back the next day. How do we get down from $14 million to $3 million? In part because you just can't get there to get the help. So when we talk about other things that really are not about the fines and fees and not about the bail, which I'll talk about, but why is it that we're now sending kids, and they're disproportionately African-American, instead of being sent to the principal's office, as they used to be, we have these school officers who arrest kids, and they get sent to juvenile court, and in Texas and Wyoming, into adult court for some little fracas on a playground. It's the same underlying attitude about people. The feeling that they're not respected, and worse. We're talking about almost 300,000 people a year, kids, get sent to court for something that should have gone to the principal's office. We have a problem that you have in parts of New York is ordinances where if a woman calls 911 too often, the police have the power to tell the landlord to throw the person out, to evict them. It's insane. These are people who are calling to get protection about there might be violence against them, and instead they end up evicted. The ACLU is doing major work on that, and a lot of these things, people do fight back, and that's so important.
Out to clarify that a little bit. Very often what happens in public housing and so on is that if a woman is subject to domestic violence and calls the police, the landlord may deem, because of the disruption that follows, quote-unquote, that she is a nuisance, and uses that as a basis for commencing eviction proceedings, whether in an administrative case in public housing or in the private housing sector in the city courts, which is, the criminalization. But,
But let's be clear about that. There's a lot of research that's been done where the landlord did not want to throw the person out.
Oh, absolutely. And it's a travesty. And, of course, my office defends against that. But it's part of your whole thesis and issues of, again, the criminalization of people who are in impoverished states.
Yeah, I just want to get into some of the ways that the government takes money away from poor people and in some cases locks them up if they can't pay. You want to expand on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So this whole list of things that we've talked about here, which aren't about money, the police and others and bureaucrats and others, not for any really excusable thing at all. The second thing happened here, and, you know, I worked on the poverty issues that we've been talking about today for decades. I was not aware of what we discovered in Ferguson. Starting with the anti-tax rebellion, it's really the Reagan period when it starts, states and court systems and municipalities were starving for money, and what they did, it's a time of paying for a lot of kinds of things that used to be there as services, and so they built up these enormous fines and fees, which if somebody gets arrested for literally telling an actual story, a man who is intellectually disabled, and he was just burning the leaves in his backyard, and he didn't have a permit for that, and the police came and took him down to the court, and he was hit for a $500 fee and a 500 so-called fees, probation that isn't probation, and of course he couldn't pay for it. Well, as the story goes on, fortunately, he did finally get a lawyer, which is extremely, extremely important. The biggest part of this kind of thing, of throwing people in jail when they can't pay a fine, and it's a fine that has been jacked up, and these things, and you pay for everything. Just heard a story about in Missouri about a man who owes now in the thousands of dollars because he can't pay for the bed and board in the county jail. I mean, it's paying for everything. It's just crazy. You pay for, they charge for probation in 44 states in this country. It's just shocking. And the biggest thing is taking away people's driver's licenses. More than 40 states do that. And that works really well from their point of view, because people have to use their car. And so they drive to work, they have to take the kids to school or whatever it might be, and they get arrested again. And it goes up and up and up, and there are all these absolutely made-up fees that go with it. The result of it is you have 10 million people in this country who owe $50 billion in all of this stuff. And the state of California, that's getting a little better about it, but they took away the driver's licenses of 4 million people. Nationally, of that 10 million people owing all that money, 7 million of those are people who lost their driver's licenses on something that has nothing to do with safety. Be very clear about this. This isn't about driving under the influence. This is getting money to pay for running the government. It's just absolutely all over the country, almost 2 million people in Texas, et cetera, et cetera. If you're in juvenile, they have fines and fees all over the country. You know, I was the commissioner of juvenile stuff in New York in the 70s, and I just couldn't believe that this was happening. You know, it's not services, it's squeezing people for money. It's modern peonage. It's big business. Two out of every three people who get inmates who get out owe unpaid fines and fees, including fees for their stays. And it's just crazy. You have an understanding that we have mass incarceration, but we really don't know that this is a national problem where the fines and fees and bail, which we haven't had time about, right. And certainly knowing about Rikers, of course, people know about bail. 700,000 people every day are in jails around the country, and 450,000 of those people are not in for anything. They're just being there waiting to be tried because they can't pay the bail. These are small, tiny things, misdemeanors, violations. They're not a threat to anybody. It's about, again, about getting money. And indeed, what happens then is the person can't get out, so they plead. What happens when you plead? You get a payment plan. And that, again, is this whole system to make money, to run whatever it is, the court system or the municipality or so on. So the bail issue, which is beginning to become an issue in your state with the new members of the legislature, and this is something for people to really get involved about, it because new laws should be, now it should be possible to get new laws to reform the bail system in New York State. So you put all these things together. We didn't talk whether it was homelessness. I mean, it just goes everywhere. Homeless people get thrown into jail over and over and over again. They're not allowed to sleep anywhere. And the main part is that those cities, and it happens city after city around the country, is to make sure that they leave that town, that they'll have to find some other place. And so this hits just so many places, between shaking people down on the money side to the because of being starved for revenues, and then all these other things that are just awful for people. that really don't have any justification. So this is all what I've written in my book, and I really appreciate the chance that I could talk with you about it.
I appreciate the chance, and I will tell you one of the most striking ones that I recently came across was a $100 surcharge for what they call aggressive begging. So if you go into a night court anytime in Brooklyn or any of the boroughs, you will see homeless people who are picked up and possibly for begging, etc., but generally being homeless. And then they are brought before the DAs and stuff, and they are put right back into the into jail by virtue of they are assessed a $100 surcharge. Now, let me see if I understand that. They are homeless, and they've
yes,
been picked
right.
up for quote-unquote begging,
right.
and then they are assessed a $100 surcharge. So what I want to know, you have been a policy analyst. You've been in the highest level of government, which you chose to leave, which I commend you for after the horrible 1996 Welfare Reform and Reconstruction Act, which was anything but. So what do you see as being accomplished, and what do you want to see happen as a result of this enormously important book, Not a Crime to Be Poor? Everybody has to get it. It is digestible. It is readable. It is strategic. We have to understand this is a feminist issue. We have to understand the link between poverty and the criminalization of the poor. Not a crime to be poor. What is to be done, Professor Peter Edelman?
The first thing is that there continues to be a challenge. They need to know about these fines and fees because that can be knocked down. As people, advocates and so on, have in some states made a difference on that. It needs people fighting back. But what the lawyers are doing and even some of the judges and some of the legislators, it needs the people to understand this. That's on the side of the fines and fees and the bail and the driver's license. On the rest of it, which is really about all the other aspects of poverty and the sort of public policy that goes with them, what we need to understand is that these are real people. There is such an attitude, such a belief that this is some different kind of person who has low income, and therefore there's something must be terrible about them because they have a low income. And that's a trouble and that we've had to get people to understand that people want to work. The vast majority, and you know, comes along somebody telling some story about somebody, and they were lazy and all that, and just over and over again. So that is not easy, but we have to take it on. And I hope with this new House of Representatives that we have in Washington, that some of these wonderful people who've been elected are going to start talking about these things as well as many other things that are very important, and have that be a place that gets it out around the country. And then, you know, I hope that we're getting to, over the course of 2020 and thereafter, a different country that's good about saving our environment and climate change and all these other things, but certainly about doing something good about poverty.
I keep thinking of, since the general reality of the contempt for the poor, the fact that there really is a tale of two cities, and now the additional reality of whether for social control or for propping up the coffers of the city treasuries, the idea of the criminalization of the poor is just absolutely, absolutely tyrannical, autocratic, anti-democratic in the extreme. I'm so glad that you have exposed this terrifying problem that is upon us, and you do so with such lucidity and such knowledge, really exploding the myth of equal treatment across class lines. People, you got to get it. It really is a book. It should be similarly as popular as Michelle Alexander's book was on incarceration, mass incarceration, Not a Crime to Be Poor, because guess what? That's an irony. It darn well is in our society, and Peter Edelman explodes it, the criminalization of poverty in America. Peter Edelman, thank you for the work that you've done all these many years. Thank you for this very important book, Not a Crime to Be Poor, The Criminalization of Poverty in America. It has been a pleasure speaking with you.
Well, for me as well. Thank you so much.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
The country just was not ready for this kind of book. It was starting to happen, but that same publisher and that editor was who we finally went to in 1973 with the front runner.
In retrospect, I had no idea what I was expecting. Some welcome party? A sense of belonging isn't something that will happen overnight, lickety-split.
Border lies, the rate for distracting from Russian ties.
I'm guilty! I'm guilty!
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Taiwan's marriage equality proposal pleases no one. The front runner crosses the finish line, and queer youth remember the Rainbow Man. Those stories and more this week because you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending February 23rd, 2019. The government of Taiwan on February 21st became the first in Asia to submit a bill to its lawmakers proposing some form of civil marriage for same-gender couples. But most everyone agrees that the proposal falls far short of full equality. Members of the Legislative Yuan, Taiwan's lawmaking authority, are faced with a deadline of May 24th to comply with the island's high court ruling in 2017, ordering them to open civil marriage to same-gender couples within 2 years. The Constitutional Court said that marriage equality would automatically come into force if lawmakers failed to act by then. To complicate the situation, Taiwan voters in November specifically rejected full marriage equality, but approved less-than-marriage civil partnerships in separate ballot measures. However, while that outcome puts pressure on lawmakers to follow suit, voters cannot overturn high court decisions. The government apparently doesn't want to change the civil code to open marriage to same-gender couples, but to create a separate category for them that is ostensibly equal to marriage with or without the name. The major anti-equality group in Taiwan, the Coalition for the Happiness of Our Next Generation, sponsored all of the homophobic measures on last November's ballot, including a ban on LGBTQ people and issues in school curricula. A spokesperson called the government's draft bill to recognize same-gender couples unacceptable.
Taiwan Premier Su Tseng-Chung said that this might fall short of expectations, but after all, it's a start, and that I really hope our homosexual friends can wait a bit longer. Jennifer Liu of Marriage Equality Coalition Taiwan told Gay Star News that it is not fair to ask the LGBT community to wait a little longer. But she said that the battle over competing anti- and pro-queer ballot measures last November has sapped many activists' energies. Many LGBT people don't have the resources to face that battle again in their lifetime, she said. This bill may be the most possible way to give almost equal rights to same-sex spouses. The current draft legislation gives one of the same-gender spouses the right to adopt the other's biological children, but does not allow joint adoption. There are no specific provisions addressing queer unions between Taiwanese citizens and foreign nationals, nor same-gender couple access to assisted reproduction. But someone in a same-gender union can be prosecuted for adultery. It remains unclear what form the same-gender couples bill will take along the road to possible passage and whether or not activists will go back to the Constitutional Court to challenge a less-than-fully equal marriage measure.
Gay and lesbian couples in 14 of Mexico's 31 states now have marriage equality. The Supreme Court of Justice of the nation this week unanimously overturned a marriage ban in Nuevo León and ordered lawmakers to create new provisions in the state's civil code to include same-gender couples. It's the third time the country's top court has struck down a state's refusal to open civil marriage to same-gender couples. Queer couples in Mexico's other 17 states can currently marry if they go to court and get an amparo, an expensive and time-consuming process that nevertheless cannot be denied by a judge. Lesbian and gay couples can already marry in the Federal District of Mexico City. Mexico's High Court ruled that all state marriage bans were unconstitutional in 2015, but it has no power to strike them down unilaterally. Each remaining state ban must be contested separately.
Kenya's Supreme Court has postponed a much-anticipated ruling on the decriminalization of gay sex that it was expected to announce on February 22nd. Justice Chacha Mwita announced instead that some of the judges were still mulling a voluminous number of files submitted for the case by several petitioners. He set a new announcement date of May 24th. Acts against the order of nature in Kenya are currently punishable by up to 14 years in prison under the penal code the East African country inherited from British colonizers.
The U.S. ambassador to Germany, Richard Grenell, the highest-profile openly gay person in the Trump administration, is leading a global effort to end the criminalization of same-gender sex. NBC News, which was first to report the initiative, said that LGBTQ activists from across Europe were being flown to Berlin this week for a strategy dinner at the U.S. Embassy on how best to push for decriminalization. Private consensual adult same-gender sex is a crime in 72 countries on the planet, mostly in the Middle East, Africa, and the Caribbean. Cynics note that the launch of the campaign was prompted by recent reports of the public executions of young gay men in Iran, a country that probably tops the president's boogeyman list. However, one of Trump's favorite Middle East countries, Saudi Arabia, is one of at least eight countries that also executes gay people. Grenell, in an editorial in the German newspaper Bild, pointed to India and a few other countries that have recently decriminalized same-gender sex among consenting adults. He said that reasonable people must continue to speak out about laws in other places, including Chechnya, the Russian region where authorities have been violently purging gay people since early 2017. Tony Perkins of the far-right Family Research Council questioned whether President Trump or anyone else in the administration authorized this campaign. But Grenell told NBC News that the initiative is widely supported by both parties. A tweet from queer media watchdog group GLAAD said that, "We'd believe that the Trump administration will work to protect LGBTQ people around the world if they had not attacked LGBTQ people in the U.S. over 90 times since taking office." For his part, the president seemed oblivious to the effort when a reporter asked him about it this week.
Your push to decriminalize homosexuality around the world.
I don't know which report you're talking about. We have many reports. Anybody else?
In other news, actor Jussie Smollett was arrested in Chicago late this week and charged with felony disorderly conduct for filing a false police report. Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman reports.
Smollett is said to have faked an attack that sparked widespread outrage last month. The actor, a star on Fox's hit TV show Empire, told police he was violently attacked on the street in an apparent hate crime. Smollett, who is African-American and gay, said the attacker shouted homophobic and racist slurs as well as, quote, "This is MAGA country," and placed a rope around his neck. Police say Smollett paid the two brothers, who were personal acquaintances of Smollett, to carry out a staged attack. The Chicago Police Department cite records from a hardware store where the brothers purchased the rope and surveillance video of them picking up other supplies. Earlier this week, local media reported the attack was planned after a racist letter addressed to Smollett and sent to the Empire studio did not receive much attention. The letter contained a white powder, which was later determined to be aspirin. The FBI is now reportedly investigating the letter. Jussie Smollett has rejected the recent reports and maintains he gave a truthful account of the attack. I'm Amy Goodman.
Though Smollett received initial support from several celebrities and politicians and from the cast of Empire, its producers announced late this week that he's been suspended and that his character is being written out of the last two episodes of the season. Some stories claim that he cooked up the scheme in an attempt to boost his salary, which had reportedly earned him from $65,000 to up to $125,000 per episode. Smollett has been released on bail of $100,000 and faces up to 3 years behind bars if he's found guilty of felony disorderly conduct for filing a false police report.
But finally, some happier news. The family of Serbia's lesbian prime minister, Ana Brnabic, grew by one this week as her partner, Milica Djordjevic, gave birth to a healthy baby boy through artificial insemination. Brnabic's appointment as Serbia's first female and first out prime minister in 2017 by the country's populist president was a surprise. Sexual and gender minorities in the Balkan nation face routine harassment and sometimes violent assaults. There are no anti-discrimination laws, and same-gender couples are not legally recognized. But the couple has attended public events together without incident. They met at a Belgrade gay bar. Djordjevic works as a doctor. Brnabic was scheduled as head of state to visit Brussels this week to lobby for Serbia's admission to the European Union. But she postponed the trip to be with her spouse and new family addition. The PM's office announced that both birth mother and baby, whom the couple has named Igor, are doing fine.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending February 23rd, 2019. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazer, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us in ears around the world at the ever-updating thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
The race may be over, but her inspiring trail will never be erased. This Way Out's Lucia Chappell reports.
Author, activist, youth advocate, lesbian feminist rabble-rouser, and long-distance runner, Patricia Nell Warren died of lung cancer at the age of 82 on February 9th in Santa Monica, California. Warren's storied career is known the world over, but the backstory of the woman who brought queer stories into the foreground may not be so familiar. She talked about her early life in a 1994 interview with This Way Out's Josie Cotoggio.
Tell me a little bit first about yourself and your life, because very many people know your work, but they don't really know much about you, and why a woman would write primarily novels about gay men.
Well, I very much grew up among men on a big cattle ranch in Montana. I was a very butch tomboy kid. I grew up in muddy cowboy boots, totally surrounded with men and for the most part. And so really throughout my life, I've had a real big concern for what goes on in their heads, the negative side as well as the positive side, and a very big concern for them as human beings. I think that men in our culture are every bit as messed up as women are and in desperate need of healing and healing between the sexes. And I look at myself as a writer and a person who is that kind of bridge. I think we need that kind of common understanding.
And when did you first become aware of your own gayness?
Well, I certainly didn't think of it as gayness at the time, but I was 12 going on 13 years old, and there was she was a town girl, and who was just, I thought, the most beautiful thing that walked the earth. This was a time when Gone with the Wind was around again on reruns in the theaters, and every girl in town was very much into digging their mom's old chiffon dresses out of the trunk in the basement, and we would have slumber parties where everybody sort of dressed up in Civil War drag, and I kind of thought of her as my Scarlet, and I was her Rhett Butler. And I certainly did not think of it as lesbian. I had never heard people talk about homosexuality, never heard the word lesbian. That didn't come until much later. All I knew was how I felt about her.
So what happened as you grew up? What changed?
I did the thing that many, many women do, which is that I really tried to fit into the whole heterosexual conformity of our culture. And I really tried to pour myself into dresses and to get married. And I was married for 13 years. I mean, I really gave it a good try. The marriage was, on the one hand, a very painful and very negative experience. And on the other hand, it taught me a lot of things that I certainly wouldn't know if I hadn't gone through it. And all of this time, I had been a writer and was honing my skills as a writer, starting from when I was in my mid-teens. And the subject was there inside of me as a beingness, and I knew that I wanted to write about it. The question was, how open would I dare to be?
So this was still the 50s, right?
This was still the 50s. And then on into the 60s, during a time when I lived in Spain and I was still married, and finally sat down to write what was, in effect, the first gay novel. My agent showed it to a publisher, William Morrow, in the late 60s, and at that time Morrow wasn't yet ready. The country just was not ready for this kind of book yet. It was starting to happen, but that same publisher and that editor, Jim Landis, was who we finally went to in 1973 with The Front Runner.
Patricia Nell Warren's 1974 novel, The Front Runner, is about a closeted conservative ex-Marine coach and his liberating romance with a younger Olympic athlete. It was the first queer-themed book to capture the hearts of a general audience, the first to use the word gay on the cover, the first to make the New York Times bestseller list. Warren said her goal was not just to depict a gay relationship, she also wanted to challenge the myths of masculinity embedded in the sports world. Her myth-busting went beyond that. Warren was one of a dozen women who crashed the Boston Marathon in 1969 to protest discriminatory restrictions on female runners. A longtime editor at Reader's Digest, Warren participated in a mid-70s class-action lawsuit to fight the magazine's discrimination against women writers. In 1997, her Wildcat Press joined the ACLU and others suing the Justice Department to stop efforts to censor the internet and strangle online sales of queer content. Warren worked tirelessly to protect the rights of LGBTQ youth, championing legislation and programs for at-risk students. The Front Runner and its two sequels continue to empower both young queers and adults. Patricia Nell Warren was also an early hero for This Way Out. She served on our advisory board, donated autographed copies of her books for our supporters, and wrote endorsement letters to funders. Again, Patricia Nell Warren passed away on February 9th. She is survived by millions of fans around the world who say her books, essays, and actions saved their lives. For This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell.
Brother to brother, brother to brother, brother to brother, brother to brother.
This is Essex Hemphill, reminding you that you've tuned into This Way Out.
We will have a national emergency, and they will sue us in the Ninth Circuit, and we will possibly get a bad ruling, and then we'll get another bad ruling, and then we'll end up in the Supreme Court.
I love this song.
Sing along with Trump and Randy Rainbow later in the program.
Everyone thinks that I'm a freak, the way I dress, the way I speak. I'm too thin, I hate my voice. I'd switch lives if I had the choice. I'll be tall and rich someday. Everything will go my way. Someday, someday.
The Outcasting Overtime crew pays tribute to another lost inspirational figure.
This is Outcasting Overtime, a feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Hi, I'm Drew, a youth participant in Outcasting's main studio in Westchester County, New York. On this edition, Outcaster Alex reflects upon his speech at the gay activist Gilbert Baker's memorial rally in June of 2017.
Many of our guests join us over the phone, but Gilbert wanted to meet us and get to know us, so he came in person. After our interview, we talked with him for a couple of hours. The conversations I had with him were more thought-provoking than any others I've had. Few schools teach gay history. Mine certainly hasn't. Many obituaries credit the creation of the rainbow flag to a challenge from Harvey Milk. Gilbert told me that, although it makes for a good story, it isn't true. As Milk gained more prominence, so did Gilbert's rainbow flag designs. He told me that there was a real need to push for change and reform. He thought that if we didn't confront our representatives for denying us our rights, then they would never give them to us.
Gilbert was interviewed by Alex on Outcasting a month before he died. To the best of our knowledge, it was Gilbert's last interview. Both the interview with Gilbert and a recording of Alex's speech can be found on our website, outcastingmedia.org.
One of my first interviews after I joined Outcasting was with Gilbert Baker, the creator of the rainbow flag. His activism spanned decades, from his time working with Harvey Milk through the AIDS crisis, up until a few weeks after our interview, when he died suddenly and unexpectedly. As a young queer person who hadn't explored beyond the straight world, the LGBTQ community felt alien to me. There weren't any gay celebrities who particularly resonated with me except for Ellen DeGeneres, but her cheery and effervescent attitude seemed comically opposite to mine growing up, sullen and antagonistic. And there weren't any gay-themed events or organizations that I could go to except for Outcasting, which I had joined fairly recently. My life felt like a waiting game until I was in college, where I would be able to embrace my identity unlike in high school. But then this speech came up in my life, and I latched onto it as a moment of entry for me into that community, cathartic and life-changing. Finally, a beginning to my own story. Then the day finally came. I drove down to the city, unfortunately after eating a massive bowl of spicy noodles. I made the speech. Then there was applause, and it was over. That was it. My friends who were there and my family congratulated me. I told everyone that I had enjoyed it, despite being a bit nervous. But, on the inside, I felt confused and irresolute, scared by the absence of relief that I thought I would feel. In retrospect, I had no idea what I was expecting. Some welcome party? I beat myself up over the memory of the day. I had imagined that I would want to tell all my friends about it, every detail. I ended up not really mentioning it. My life hadn't changed, and I sunk back into routine. All the while, my view of the speech grew worse and worse. I began to think of it as a failure, in order to explain why my expectations were so wrong. I couldn't figure out why it wasn't a cathartic moment, and why I was only left with emptiness. One day, my brother sent me a link to an article in Teen Vogue, in which a two-sentence blurb about my speech was written, along with a quote from it. I felt conflicted about seeing my name there, still carrying my confused resentment. But, just for a moment, I allowed myself to feel the slightest sliver of satisfaction. I went back and watched a video of the speech, which I hadn't done before, and let myself have another moment, seeing myself up in that stage. And I made myself start to tell my friends who I hadn't told before. Slowly, my opinions began to change. Now I do see it as a pivotal moment of my life, but not for the reasons I thought I would, and not to the same effect. When the day didn't go exactly as I had planned, I jumped to look for what I did wrong. Now, looking back, I can't find anything. So I see that my only mistake was before the day itself, in my inflated expectations. And I expected to learn something about community and how to find one I fit into. I did. A sense of belonging isn't something that will happen overnight, lickety-split. It's something that is completely in my control, but that I have to work on over time, trying to involve myself with people in groups, not big, lofty ideas.
Thanks for listening to Outcasting Overtime, a feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Outcasting Overtime is a production of Media for the Public Good, a nonprofit independent producer based in New York. Our executive producer is Mark Sofis. Visit us at outcastingmedia.org to get information about Outcasting, watch Outcasting videos, access our social media links, and listen to Outcasting and Outcasting Overtime. Thanks, and thanks for listening.
Madonna plus Randy Rainbow equals another tune to tango with the Trumpster.
Yes, go ahead. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. President. Will you, in fact, declare a national emergency at the southern border?
I'll sign the final papers as soon as I get into the Oval Office, and we will have a national emergency, and we will then be sued, and they will sue us in the Ninth Circuit, even though it shouldn't be there, and we will possibly get a bad ruling, and then we'll get another bad ruling, and then we'll end up in the Supreme Court.
I love this song.
And hopefully we'll get a fair shake, and we'll win in the Supreme Court, just like the ban. They sued us in the Ninth Circuit, and we lost, and then we lost in the appellate division.
Sweetie.
And then we won.
Some say that you're just concocting this crisis to get the money for your wall. Well, I mean, it was a wall, and then it was a fence. What's it today? Some chicken wire and an ADT security decal?
No.
Couple of Doberman pinchers and a sprinkler? Thank you.
You're fake news.
Some say that you're just fear-mongering and using inflated statistics to help your own agenda.
Not too many people have said that.
Some say that you're full of sh**, and others, well, agree. That you're just fomenting fear and hate with your hyperbole.
Drugs and gangs and people, it's an invasion.
Now push has come to shove. You shut down the gov just to try and get your way.
I didn't need to do this.
Your only interest is campaign promises. Can we believe a word you say?
No.
Girl, you're at an impasse. Now they're gonna sue your ass. But you just keep pushing me.
You don't have a border. You don't have a country.
Border lies. Freaking us out while you traumatize all the stats you claim you've been shown back in your border lies.
Border lies.
Border lies. Great for distracting from Russian ties. More insulting than your skin tone. Talking about border lies.
Border lies.
Sir, you told us that Mexico would reimburse us for the wall. Is it true that you will allow them to pay entirely with 20% off coupons from Bed Bath & Beyond?
Where the hell did that come from?
I have my sources. My mom posted it on Facebook.
Well, he's quick to rush to racist, rash decisions on a whim.
I could do the wall over a longer period of time. I didn't need to do this.
But the only national emergency we have is him.
And by the way, Trump is crazy.
He dupes and he deceives, but still his base believes the MAGA mantras he repeats.
Make America great again.
He said that Mexico would pay for it if so. And I'd sure like to see your receipts.
No.
Girl.
Hit that Adderall.
Take a sip
and go get your border wall. And stop being such a tease.
We're getting it done.
Border lies. Even Ann Coulter is getting wise. You're just walking like a parrot. Echoing border lies.
Border lies.
Border lies. Let's just hope your face doesn't recognize. You're just dangling a carrot
to rest up in border lies.
Sorry. Guess I got a little carried away.
Let's not talk about it.
Okay. It's too bad Mike Pence is in here. He loves Madonna.
I don't know her.
Border lies.
Thank you very much.
You can find more of Randy Rainbow's political parodies at randyrainbow.com.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Tanya Kane Perry and Christopher Gall, produced with Brian DeShazer, and from Alicia Chappelle and Outcasters Drew and Alex, produced by Mark Sofis. You heard music from the Chariots of Fire movie soundtrack and by David Brown, Madonna, and Randy Rainbow. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks to Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, Paul Bannon, Christopher Matthews, Judd Proctor and Brian Burns, Richard Merkin, Brad Payton of Silicon Valley, and all of the listener donors who make this program possible. You can join them by visiting thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening online at thiswayout.org and on 2HOT, Cobart, New South Wales, KGIGLP, Modesto, California, WMBR, Cambridge, Massachusetts, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Thank you. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on listener-sponsored KPFA and KPFA.org. My name is C.S. Song. It's an age-old question, how to generate and cultivate happiness and joy. That endeavor seems devilishly difficult in these times of social and political turmoil, but there is someone out there with a lot of wisdom, a lot of insight, a Zen master who has traveled the world, teaching people to cultivate and to mindfully take care of themselves and others. The name of this Buddhist monk, teacher, author, and poet is Thich Nhat Hanh. He's one of the most important and respected and beloved Zen masters and spiritual teachers living today. He's also a veteran peace activist. Dr. King nominated Thich Nhat Hanh for the Nobel Peace Prize in 1967. On November 11, 2014, Thich Nhat Hanh suffered a severe stroke that paralyzed most of the right side of his body and took away his ability to speak. Last October, after celebrating his 92nd birthday, he expressed a wish to return from France to Vietnam to live his remaining days. Today, we've got a truly eye-opening thank you gift for listeners who want to pledge to KPFA. It's a 6-CD box set. 6 hours of insights and teachings from Thich Nhat Hanh, and it's called Happiness, Love, and Liberation, Insights and Teachings from Buddhist Psychology. This 6-CD deluxe box set is your thank you gift for a pledge of $20 per month to KPFA. The phone number here is 1-800-439-5732. You can call that number anytime this hour, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You can also pledge securely online at kpfa.org. Let's turn now to excerpts from this 6-hour audio collection. Here is the Zen master, Thich Nhat Hanh.
In Buddhism, we speak of the seven elements, the seven factors of enlightenment. Enlightenment means deep understanding. In order to attain, to reach enlightenment, you need six factors. It's very interesting to see the Buddhist way of approaching the ultimate reality. And one of the factors of enlightenment is the factor relaxation, ease. If you are not relaxed, if you are tense, you cannot touch the ultimate. You cannot get enlightenment. So we all we have to practice releasing the tension and relax. When we sit, when we walk, when we meditate, relaxation is one of the factors of enlightenment. Is you have the feeling of lightness in your body, in your mind, and you have the feeling of peace. If you don't have that, don't hope for enlightenment. And there is another factor called factors of enlightenment. It's called joy. Joy. This is the Buddhist approach to knowledge, to understanding, to enlightenment. You need joy. So, if you are a good practitioner, you should be able to generate joy. Otherwise, you cannot get enlightened. You cannot become a Buddha. You cannot get the right view. That is the Buddhist methodology, Buddhist approach. And then there is the element called mindfulness and concentration, of course. But here there is another factor that we call investigation. Investigation. With what kind of mind can you investigate reality? And adopting what kind of methodology can you investigate into the heart of reality. In science, this would be the objects of physical science. like a galaxy, the moon, the earth, the atom, the object of your investigation. You have to analyze, you have to look deeply, you have to find out what is the nature of what is there. That is the factor of investigation. When someone suffers and does not know how to handle the suffering in himself or herself, he becomes the victim of his own suffering. They cannot get out of that suffering. He cannot transform that suffering. And he can make other people around him suffer, around her suffer. It's not his intention to make you suffer. You suffer because that person does not know how to handle the suffering in himself. And that is why his suffering is spilled over. And you become the second victim. It's not his intention to make you suffer. You have to see that. And that person needs help. That person does not need punishment. What that person needs is help. And who is going to help him? You. You are a practitioner. You have to help yourself first. And then you will help him or her. If we know how to handle the suffering in us, if we can understand the nature of our own suffering, we suffer less. We feel lighter. We accept ourselves. We do not blame ourselves. We are at peace with ourselves. And you are in position to help him. You want him or her to do like you. And that is why you use the fourth mindfulness training. You come to him and said, "Darling, I know you suffer. And in the past, I did not understand the suffering. And I have reacted in such a way that make you suffer more and I suffer more. It's not my intention to make you suffer, dear one. It's because I did not understand your suffering. And I did not understand my suffering either. Now, the situation is better. I have understood my suffering. And I want to understand your suffering. Because understanding your suffering, your difficulties, will help me to behave in such a way that can be helpful. So if you really care for, please help me. Tell me of what is in your heart. I want to listen. I want to understand. Tell me about your suffering, your difficulties. If you do not help me, who will? That is loving speech. And when you have the energy of compassion in your heart, you can use that speech very easily. It's come very naturally. There are many people who hate their father, who can never say something sweet to their father. And yet after a few days of practice, looking at their own suffering and the suffering of their father, they were able to use loving speech. You have to practice breathing, walking, so that you are calm, that you can understand your own suffering and his or her suffering. And in just 3-4 days, there is transformation. And when you compose a number and you hear his voice, suddenly you find yourself capable of speaking like that, using the language of loving kindness. "Daddy, I know that you have suffered a lot during the last many years. I could not help you. I only made the situation worse. I have reacted with anger and stubbornness because I did not understand your difficulty, your suffering. It's not my intention, Daddy, to make you suffer. It's about my ignorance, about my own suffering and your suffering. Now I have understood some of our suffering. I feel much better. And I would like to know that it's not my intention to make you suffer, Father. just because I did not understand your suffering, so please help me. If you don't help me, who will? Tell me, Daddy, about your suffering, your difficulties. And they find it natural that they can speak like that just after 3-4 days of practice. And when you speak like that, the heart of the other person will open right away. And that person will tell you, and now you practice deep listening, compassionate listening. And 1 hour of listening like that will heal him, heal her very quickly. You are the bodhisattva of deep listening. If you know how to listen with compassion, you can heal. You can heal him, you can heal her, and you can heal yourself. The bodhisattva of deep listening is in your heart. The seat of understanding, the seat of compassion are well in you. And we need mindfulness in order to touch off these seats, in order to be able to understand, to be compassionate, and suddenly we find ourselves capable of talking like that and listening like that, in order to restore communication and to heal. In any relationship, this is possible. Even between two groups of people, two nations, the practice of deep listening, the use of loving speech is very important. And if it happens that you are not satisfied, you are not proud of what you have thought, you have said, you can do something in order to reach her, to change. And it is wonderful to know that if you have the practice, then you don't have to run after that thought in order to try to catch up and change. You stay here in the right, in the here and the now. Because that action is a kind of force that is exerting its power on you and on others. And you stay right here, and you breathe in, breathe out mindfully, and you say, I'm aware that the thought that I produced yesterday was not worth of me. It does not have enough compassion and forgiveness. I can do better. And being aware of that, in the here and the now, you will give rise to another thought that is full of compassion and awareness and forgiveness. And as soon as you have produced that thought, the thought produced can catch up in no time at all, the other thought, and delete it or transform it. That is wonderful concerning the practice. You don't have to go to the past in order to fix the past. You are there, right in the here and the now. And by using your mindfulness, concentration, you create understanding and compassion, and you can change even the past. You can change even the future. Remember the story of Mahamaya, who was pregnant of Siddhartha. The way she lived is very important. The way she spent her hours and her days is very important for Siddhartha. Our children, even if you are still a young person, we are not a mother or a father yet, but our children are already there in potential, as potential. Only time is needed for them to manifest. And the way we live our daily life affects them already. Our children and grandchildren will be happy or not, it depends on how we live our day today. If we drink alcohol, if we destroy our liver, if we allow ourselves to be victims of despair, and that is not good for our children in us. So in the here and the now, you can affect the present, not only the present, you can affect, you have the power on the past, and you have the power on the future. That is why mindfulness practice is to learn how to handle the present moment. And if you handle the present moment the best you can, you are doing everything you can do in order to change the past and prepare for the future. There is freedom. Free will is possible with mindfulness.
It's Thich Nhat Hanh, the global spiritual leader, the Zen master, the Nobel Peace Prize nominee. And that's his voice speaking on just an amazing extended 6-CD, 6-hour box set. It's his teachings and insights. It's called Happiness, Love, and Liberation, Insights and Teachings from Buddhist Psychology. My name is C.S. Song. This is Against the Grain, and this is listener-sponsored KPFA. And we're going to go back to more of Thich Nhat Hanh in just a moment, but I want to let you know that for a $20 a month pledge to KPFA, you can get this 6-CD, 6-hour box set. It's a beautifully produced set, so much insight and wisdom and advice and suggestions and you know, the gentle wisdom, the gentle but profound and powerful wisdom of Thich Nhat Hanh coming your way. Arguably more valuable than your $20 a month pledge to KPFA. So if you want something valuable in return for your valuable donation to listener-sponsored KPFA, no advertising, no underwriting, no mini commercials, no credits at the end of the hour, no wealth management companies, no oil companies, no Silicon Valley tech companies, no messages, no little messages, no big messages. We've got the people's voices, and we've got the voices of people like Thich Nhat Hanh to share with you. And that's what we do here at KPFA. And it's an underdog operation. And if you want to support it, the phone number is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or 1-800-HEY-KPFA. It's hard to remember, hard to forget the phone number if you just think, hey, KPFA, I want to give something, and in this case, I want to get something, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You can also donate online at kpfa.org. $20 a month gets you Happiness, Love, and Liberation, this 6-CD deluxe box set, with packed full of Thich Nhat Hanh and his teachings, his timeless teachings, his profound teachings, his teachings that he's developed over many, many years. I mean, the guy is well over 90 years old, and his life is an incredible adventure, and people for so many decades have flocked to see him and to be with him and to listen to him. And this is your chance to listen to a great deal of Thich Nhat Hanh and to get the benefits of his teachings about listening, about healing, about being present, about being with other people, about thinking about your suffering, about thinking about and dealing with and helping people through other people's suffering. 1-800-439-5732. If you want to make a pledge all at once, it's $250 in one fell swoop, $250 or $20 a month to KPFA, 1-800-439-5732. I'm going to tell you just a little bit about his life, and then we are going to go back to Thich Nhat Hanh. So Thich Nhat Hanh, next to His Holiness the Dalai Lama, is the best-known Buddhist teacher in the world. And he was born in Vietnam. He was born on October 11th, 1926. He joined a Zen monastery at the age of 16, and it is to that monastery that he said that he wanted to live out the remainder of his life last October. So for 4 months now, he has been in Vietnam after being in France for many, many years. He was ordained as a monk in 1949, And he has founded, in the early 60s, he founded the School of Youth for Social Services in Saigon. And he traveled to the U.S. to study at Princeton, later lecture at Cornell and Columbia. His focus at the time was to urge the U.S. government to withdraw from Vietnam. He urged Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. to publicly oppose the Vietnam War, and King nominated Thich Nhat Hanh for the Nobel Peace Prize in January 1967. He established monastic and practice centers around the world. He went into exile in France in 1973 when the Vietnamese government denied him permission to return to Vietnam. From 76 to 77, he led efforts to rescue Vietnamese boat people in the Gulf of Siam. He has become an important influence in the development of Western Buddhism. He coined the term engaged Buddhism, so Buddhism that engages with the outside world, with social issues, with political issues, with environmental issues. He coined the term engaged Buddhism in one of his books. He's a living legend. We don't know how long, much longer he'll be alive. He did have a devastating stroke. He experienced a devastating stroke in 2014, has never fully recovered. He went through a lot of rehab. He was paralyzed, much of his body, and he lost the ability to speak. And as of at least last November, he still could not speak. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Given his health condition and given the condition of the world, you might agree that it's time to reflect on Thich Nhat Hanh and his life and his ideas and the ways in which his ideas can help you, not kind of in special moments or only in moments of intense crisis, but everyday life, everyday living, everyday thinking, everyday perceiving what he can do for you to help you get the most out of each and every day, to get the most out of each and every relationship you have, to help heal wounds, whether they be mental or emotional or spiritual, and to learn to communicate better with people. I'm always working on that. And to be with oneself, to be with oneself, to gain a certain kind of peace of mind and equanimity. Let's return now to more of Thich Nhat Hanh. Again, this is from a 6-CD, 6-hour deluxe box set. It's called Happiness, Love, and Liberation, Insights and Teachings from Buddhist Psychology. Here's Thich Nhat Hanh.
And this is very important in Buddhism because in Buddhism we distinguish two kinds of truth, the conventional truth and the ultimate truth. In the conventional realm of truth, you can speak of birth and death, being and non-being, you and I, time and space as separate entities. And you can apply that kind of knowledge into technology and into your daily life also. For instance, every one of us need a birth certificate in order to have an identity card and a passport. Without that, you cannot you cannot go anywhere. You cannot say that, well, my nature is the nature of no birth and no death. I don't need a birth certificate. You see? So this kind of conventional truth does help. Yeah. And in the ultimate truth, we know that it's impossible for a cloud to die. A cloud cannot pass from the realm of being into non-being. That is the ultimate truth. But when someone dies, you have to declare that he has died. You cannot say that, well, he can never die. He's like a cloud. So I don't need to declare his death. You cannot do that. So in the conventional truth, we make use of notions of birth and death, being and non-being. You and I are different. Father and son are two distinct persons. You cannot mix up. Although in the ultimate truth, you can see the father in the son. If you remove the father from the son, he cannot He can no longer be there. You might like to invite your father to sit with you and to breathe with you. Our father is fully present in every cell of our body. And that is why when we invite our father to sit with us, he will do that. And with your invitation, he will do it. Breathing in, I invite my father to breathe in with me. Father and son, enjoy breathing in. You can practice like that. Breathing out, I invite my mom to enjoy breathing out with me. Breathing out, mother and daughter, enjoy breathing out together. So your mother will be very real. And you are breathing in and out with your mother. Your mother in you is not a mental construction. She is real. She has transmitted herself to you. And every cell of your body, your mother is there. If you sit beautifully and you smile happily, your mother in every cell of you also smile beautifully. And this is a miracle that you can perform right in here and now. You have encountered the Buddha Dharma. It means that our parents have encountered the Buddha Dharma. You have encountered the Buddha Dharma. You know the practice. That is why all our ancestors encountered the Buddha Dharma. And you can invite all your ancestors to enjoy breathing in and breathing out with you. You are not an isolated being. You have no separate self. You are made of ancestors. And when you breathe out relaxingly, all your ancestors in you breathe out relaxingly. We have to see that. That is only insight. There is no separate self. We are a current. We are a stream. We are a continuation. We are a continuum. And that we have to see. We have learned that the self is made only of non-self elements. And when the self breathes in, all non-self elements are breathing in. And we have blood ancestors in us. We have spiritual ancestors in us. Suppose you are reaching out for something sweet to eat. A cake, a big piece of cake. And because you have learned mindfulness, suddenly you are aware that you are doing so, that you are reaching out. And mindfulness helps you to ask, why I'm reaching out for the cake? I'm not hungry. Why do I have to eat? And many of us are like that. And you may get the insight that there's some worry in you, some anxiety in you, some irritation in you, and you automatically reaching out something to eat and then forget to cover up the loneliness, the irritation in you, and that has become a habit because that has been settled as a neural pathway in your brain. And as a practitioner, you have to change the way to change the neural pathway. Otherwise, the habit energy will always lead you to suffering. You should allow mindfulness and concentration to intervene in order for you to not to become again and again the victim of that suffering. Suppose you are in a discussion group and you have a chance to speak up about your suffering. And you may choose to speak in your suffering. You might follow the old way, remember the suffering and express your suffering in a way that will make you suffer like other times. Or you might choose another way. And while speaking, you use mindfulness and concentration.
the Buddhist teacher, Zen master, poet, peace activist Thich Nhat Hanh. That's his voice speaking on a 6-CD, 6-hour box set. It's called Happiness, Love, and Liberation, Insights and Teachings from Buddhist Psychology. I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on KPFA. Kirsten Thomas is at the controls. I'm delighted to be able to bring you the voice of Thich Nhat Hanh and to tell you that there are 6 hours of Thich Nhat Hanh on this 6-CD box set. And for a $20 a month pledge to KPFA, maybe that's, I don't know, film and popcorn, a large popcorn. $20 a month to KPFA, you get this 6-CD box set as your thank you gift for making a financial pledge to non-commercial, non-corporate, stubbornly independent, dissent-oriented KPFA. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Don't go anywhere. We have some more Thich Nhat Hanh to present for you. You can also donate online at kpfa.org. $20 a month gets you this 6-CD box set. 6 hours of audio on 6-CD. He talks a good deal about being present, of course, and how to take action on the kind of mental, emotional, and spiritual level. What he's saying is that staying present and in the moment leads to clear thinking. You know, you're able to assess and evaluate your situation more accurately, more honestly. And based on that, you can decide on and take the most appropriate action. I think a lot of social ills, interpersonal ills are based on people acting before grounding themselves. And I think Thich Nhat Hanh is very good at, among many other things, helping us ground ourselves in where we are and what we're doing and the present moment. He discusses a number of mindful breathing exercises. There are a number of exercises in here, including ones to help you generate a joyful feeling and ones to help you take care of your body and one on how to generate happiness. And a good part of this box set is about interpersonal communication, about how to talk, about how to be supportive, how to show you care, how to use loving speech, and how to speak with loving kindness. How to heal yourself and heal people around you is another prominent theme of this 6-CD box set. 1-800-439-5732. A $20 a month pledge gets you this 6-hour box set. How to heal yourself, how to restore communication and to heal, and how to generate the energy of understanding and compassion. You know, we throw around these words a lot. Oh, you know, forgiveness and compassion, understanding. Well, there's a lot of kind of dime store advice on these kinds of emotions and states and attitudes and how to achieve them and how to cultivate them. Thich Nhat Hanh is the real deal. He is a Buddhist teacher. He is known for his warm and generous and joyful and humorous, often, teaching style. It makes his wisdom, which is embedded, of course, in Eastern wisdom and thought, remarkably accessible and resonant to readers from all backgrounds. Readers from all cultures have found so much in Thich Nhat Hanh's teachings to benefit from, to learn from. All kinds of people from different religious backgrounds or no religious background have found him to be an amazing teacher and kind of a mentor. And so we are offering this to you. The fund drive, frankly, is not doing very well, and I don't like to talk about the fund drive and the amounts we need to make, but there is a special urgency because last week, for whatever reason, there was not a lot of people calling in and giving their support to KPFA. And so the second week of KPFA's winter fund drive is very important. And every minute and every pledge counts. And if you don't have $20 a month to give to get Happiness, Love, and Liberation by Thich Nhat Hanh, you can pledge at any of a variety of levels. And you can ask the phone volunteers what you can get, the different kinds of thank you gift. Or you may just decide you want to give to KPFA and have us benefit from the full amount of your pledge, because then we don't have to purchase anything and send something your way and do all the packaging that is required to get a thank you gift to you. But we're happy to do that. So however you want to give and whatever you want to give, we are open and to your generosity, and we hope that maybe you understand and appreciate the generosity of this station and its programmers and the kinds of information that we give you without requiring you to give anything. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. We're going to go back to more of Thich Nhat Hanh, but I want to let you know we've been given a match of $600 by David, by one person, David, a real-life listener in San Jose, California. He's put up $600, but he's put it up conditionally. He wants people to match him dollar for dollar until the end of this hour. So your dollars are doubled now. $20 a month becomes $40 a month, and you still get Happiness, Love, and Liberation, the 6-CD, 6-hour box set by Thich Nhat Hanh if you want to give $25 to KPFA, we get $50, $100, we get $200. You get the idea. Make your pledge dollars go even further because of David in San Jose. 1-800-439-5732. Here's more of Thich Nhat Hanh. This comes again from this box set called Happiness, Love, and Liberation.
With mindfulness and concentration and insight, we can very well generate a feeling of joy to nourish ourselves and to generate a feeling of happiness whenever we want. We know that when we begin to breathe in mindfully, we bring our mind home to our body, and suddenly we are fully present in the here and the now. And established in the here and the now, we are able to recognize the many conditions of happiness that are available in the here and the now, more than enough for us to be happy. You know that the French has a very good song called Qu'est-ce qu'on attend pour être heureux? Why do you wait in order to be happy? You can be happy right now, right here. Because when you are home to the here and the now, you discover that so many conditions of happiness available already. You don't have to go to the future and look for some more conditions of happiness. And these conditions of happiness are more than enough. And that is why mindfulness that can help us go home to the here and the now and recognize all these conditions of happiness are already there. That can already help us to generate a feeling of joy. And another way of generating joy and happiness, allowing joy and happiness to come, is to the practice of releasing. You might think that to have more fame can make you happier. You might think that to have more money, more power will make you happy, more sex will make you happy. You are caught by these ideas. And that is why you might be tempted to run after these objects of your desire. And many of us are running after these objects and suffer very deeply. And that is why release them, to let go of that idea that happiness cannot be without fame and power and wealth and sex. And that is why let go, releasing, is a source of happiness. And in Buddhism, we speak of joy and happiness generated by the act of releasing. Joy and happiness are born from the act of releasing. Let go. This is done very quickly. If you are released, if you are able to release that, you can be happy right away. You don't have to go anywhere to get happiness. One day the Buddha was sitting with his monks, and a farmer went by. He stopped and asked, My dear monks, have you seen my cows going through here? The Buddha said, what cows? He said that, well, I have a number of cows, but I don't know why this morning they all run away. They have run away. I cannot find them. And I have a few acres of sesame seed plant, and the insect eat them all. So I think I'm going to kill myself. And the Buddha said, dear friend, we have not seen your cows passing over here. You may like to go and look for them in the other direction. And after the farmer was gone, the Buddha turned back to his monks, looking at them and smiled. And he said, my dear friends, you are very lucky. You don't have any cows to lose. So the techniques, the secret is how to release your cows. So if you are a good practitioner.
That is Thich Nhat Hanh sharing one of many stories and tales and wisdom tales of the Buddhist tradition, of Eastern traditions, with his audience. It was a live audience, and it has been recorded. There are 6 hours on 6 CDs of Thich Nhat Hanh. It's called Happiness, Love, and Liberation. Happiness, Love, and Liberation. Insights and teachings from Buddhist psychology, not Buddhist philosophy, although there's a lot of philosophy in there, but Buddhist psychology. It's about reorienting our minds away from what he calls conventional truth. He says we are caught by so many ideas. We are taught so many things that lead to our suffering, our feeling unsatisfied, our having a sense of dis-ease. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. We are in a matching period. $20 a month gets you, as a thank you gift, the Happiness, Love, and Liberation 6-hour 6-CD box set by Thich Nhat Hanh. I'm CS alongside Sasha Lilly. And, you know, there are times when, you know, we give things, we offer things, and we are totally happy to do that. And I feel like, okay, if someone makes a pledge of a certain amount, they're getting something in return. Of course they're giving something in return. Well, in this case, I think there's a distinct possibility you're getting back more in return than you are with your pledge. So $20 a month. $20 a month toward your, if you could think of it this way, toward your sense of balance, of equanimity, your sense of peace of mind, your sense of fulfillment, your sense of satisfaction, your sense of your ability to communicate more effectively with people, to heal relationships, to possibly even deal with people who've been difficult with you. And some of this box set is about how to deal with difficult people. That might well be worth more than a $20 bill out of your pocket every month. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. I see we just lost a connection, so I cannot tell you how far along we are toward this match of $600, but it is still operative. It is still out there. So this wonderful listener, David in San Jose, is willing to match you dollar for dollar up to $600, and he will do it till the end of this hour. He'll match any other wonderful listener who wants to give any amount. Any amount is wonderful to KPFA, so we can continue on our way to our goal, so we can continue operating. We can continue bringing voices like this to you. And, you know, I thought it would be a good time to return to Thich Nhat Hanh because of many reports about his health. He is, as I mentioned earlier, he's 92 years old. He has never fully recovered from a severe stroke that paralyzed much of his body. This happened in November 2014. He did a lot of rehab, I think, including in the U.S. He was based in France at the time. And last October, he expressed a wish to return from France, his longtime home, to Vietnam, to what's called his root temple, the temple that he was ordained in, I believe, or his first temple in Vietnam, to live his remaining days. So I thought this is a great time to reflect on his legacy. And the best way to reflect on his legacy, in my mind, is to think about what he said and what he has been teaching and what he has been doing In terms of his words and how he has disseminated words of intense and profound wisdom in my mind, helping us slow down, helping us to move beyond so much that we are encouraged to pursue and pursue avidly and rapidly and without thought for consequences. 1-800-439-5732. Give us a call. Every dollar you give is doubled. It's a great time to call. We'd love to hear from you.
That's right. We'd love to hear from you right now. 1-800-439-5732 is the number to call, or kpfa.org. And as you mentioned, CS, we have $600 on the line, which means that this lovely listener will match your donation dollar for dollar till the top of the hour. You don't have to pledge the full $600, although if you can afford to pledge at a higher level, we certainly would be grateful. But please do it right now while your money will go much further. We are having a slow fund drive, I think it can be said. We are nowhere near where we should be in the fund drive so far in terms of how much we have raised. And that might be because people are focusing on other things going on in the world, and that's hard not to do. But if you think about the importance of KPFA to you and think about what it might be like to not have KPFA going into the future, or to have KPFA at much reduced capacity to bring you the news and politics and analysis and art and culture that you have come to appreciate here on the station, then please pledge accordingly. Your donations are doubled right now, so there is really no better time than to call and pledge. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. That's 1-800-HEY-KPFA. If you can pledge at the $200 level, that would be great. If you want to pledge at the $20 a month level to be a sustainer, you could pick up this 6-CD set for a $250 pledge. We really want to encourage those of you who can pledge as monthly sustainers, because that gives us a monthly infusion of the funds that we need to stay on the air. But however you do it, however much you do it at, please do it right now. KPFA needs you. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA or kpfa.org. CS, we've got 6.5 minutes left. $600 is on the line.
Yeah, and it sounds like a lot of money, but it isn't. It isn't if everybody comes together and works together and stands in solidarity with each other. I know there's a lot of talk about the Oakland teachers' strike. And that's an instance of people, not just teachers, it goes far beyond, of teachers and community coming together. Well, KPFA kind of works the same way, that we can only do it if everybody comes together and supports each other. And you might consider the fact that maybe we support you between fund drives or even during fund drives. A lot of people really like the insights shared by the people we feature on Against the Grain and other programs during fund drives. Being there for one another is important to you. I know it's important in Thich Nhat Hanh. Please give us a call. One of the best known Buddhist teachers in the world, a Zen master, Nobel Peace Prize nominee. How can you go wrong with Thich Nhat Hanh and the kinds of the exercises themselves, just the mindfulness exercises, the mindful breathing exercises he presents. You'll feel like you're sitting with Thich Nhat Hanh. I mean, people travel thousands of miles to go see Thich Nhat Hanh. You'll feel like you're with him, and he'll be present with you, and he'll guide you through exercises designed to help you not just reduce stress, because Buddhism isn't really about just, let's just eliminate stress from my life. It's about going deeper and seeking a more fulfilling way of life, a way that helps other people, that heals other people, and that heals oneself. I see that a caller left this message. I'm thrilled to be able to listen to KPFA again after so many years. I listened to KPFA when I was a teenager, and I am so grateful that you have continued your program for so long. So this person listened and then came back to the Bay Area, apparently, and is now giving. But how was KPFA kept on its feet all those years that she was away? It was by people like you. I mean, it's an act of true generosity to think about maintaining this institution, not just so that you can listen to it in the future and young people that you know, it can be around for young people you know in the future, but also people who have left and have come back and are now delighted that KPFA is still around. It's really kind of a subset. Well, we value all listeners, but there's a set of kind of heroic people out there who regularly give so that others can get something, and KPFA can be around for them. People they don't know, the donors don't know, but the satisfaction they get from that must be tremendous if they are to give to KPFA. If you are an irregular giver, we welcome you into the fold. If you haven't given for 5 years and you give $20 a month right now, well, that's like, you know, divide that by five, and it's a pretty great bargain to get happiness, love, and liberation. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or 1-800-HEY-KPFA. It's not too late to call and get in on this match to have your dollars doubled. Give us a call.
1-800-439-5732, or go to kpfa.org. And, you know, truly, KPFA, as you're really alluding to, C.S., flies in the face of the received wisdom about how people behave. Here is something that we can get for free, but, you know, you just turn on your radio and there KPFA is. And yet people continuously give because they actually realize that that the station obviously doesn't operate for free. It is something that constantly needs money to fund it, and there's this sense of tremendous altruism that runs through what KPFA is. People giving, yes, for themselves, but for their wider communities, which aren't necessarily geographic communities, communities of the left, communities of struggle, or just the communities of people where you know that if you keep KPFA going in the future, someone will turn on the radio and come across KPFA and be amazed. And it's just an astounding and uplifting thing that this institution has been here for almost 70 years. And you can support it right now, and your dollars are doubled if you pledge over the next minute and a half before the hour is up. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732 or 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You can also go to kpfa.org. But however you choose to pledge, we really ask that you do it right now while this challenge is on the line and your dollars are doubled.
And pledge for Against the Grain. Pledge to keep this program going. Maybe you rely on it. Maybe you value it. Maybe you share, you know, our social media posts with other people. Maybe you just count on Against the Grain to deliver you a very insightful and in-depth examination into key social and political issues of our time and key historical moments that can inform what we do today. So if you care about Against the Grain, if you care about the work that Sasha and I do, give us a call and let us know that you want this program to stay on the air. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. We've got 40 seconds left to go. I am delighted to say, kind of early, that we've made this match. So thank you to
fantastic.
Everyone who called. You can still call, though. You can still give to KPFA freely. You can get whatever thank you gift. You can ask for whatever thank you gift you want. It's not too late to call, and it's sort of a vote for this program and what we do on Against the Grain 3 days a week. And, you know, we're always thinking about you when we produce, when we figure out what we want to air and who we want to get on. Hopefully you'll think about us at this critical moment and keep KPFA and this program going. Thanks to Kirsten Thomas. And please keep listening to KPFA. And thanks so much for calling.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.